South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Well, a very good morning across South Texas and the Hill Country and wherever you might happen to be listening on the internet. A little windy around here this morning. Going to be a little chillier, but hey, this is just, we're barely a week into March. We can't expect it to be totally spring-like every day, but man, the past week has just been absolutely beautiful. Looks like we're going to have about 2 days of a little bit lower temperatures, but nothing approaching freezing or anything that's going to be really bad for the plants. Now, this cold wind is hard on things, and we'll talk in a little while about things you can do to protect your plants from the cold wind. But looks like we have several people already ready to talk. Looks like it's going to be Don and AJ and Clint, my first three callers. That leaves one line open if you want to grab it. And I call this the Smart People's Half Hour, where we don't have a commercial break up until 6 o'clock, so we've got a little more time to talk. Anyway, you know the number, 210-599-5555. And I say, let's just get to the phone lines. And Don is first in line. And let's see, I believe that's right. Yeah, Don's first in line. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Bob. This is Don out here at Club Christie.
Say, yes, sir.
Putting the Epsom salt on the tomatoes, how big should the tomatoes the plants should be before you start putting it on there, and how often?
I just do it once a season, and I do it when I plant them. I don't. I just sprinkle it around on the surface, you know, a good handful or two. The plants don't actually take it up. What you're doing is modifying the soil, rebalancing the calcium and magnesium in the soil. So it doesn't make any difference if the plants are little or bigger, or you can actually do it before you plant if you like. And if you'd rather put it on in a liquid form, make about 2 tablespoons per gallon of water and just use that to wet the soil down, the water the plant's in. And normally, unless you've got soil that's really kind of messed up, normally one application will get you through the entire season. I usually do it once in the spring, once in the fall, and it doesn't hurt anything else, but the tomatoes are the only place you really need it.
Right, right, right. Okay, now on the garret juice, how soon do you start putting it on the tomato plants and stuff on it? When they're young?
When they're young, it's never too early to start with them. And I would alternate the garret juice and something maybe with a little more nitrogen in it, like Has to Grow Plant or the liquid fish blend from Has to Grow.
Right,
but
right.
No, I think you can do that the day you put them in the ground.
Yeah, okay. All right, and I want to update my asparagus is doing good. I'm getting 15 to 25 asparagus, you know, a day off of my plants.
Fantastic.
And, what's the best fertilizer for the asparagus? Is it Has to Grow or?
Yeah, Has to Grow will work fine, especially while they're producing. When they're just in their growing phase, I'll take some dry granular fertilizer like the Medina Growing Green. And I'll just throw that on there. I love liquid fertilizers, and they're available to the plants, but more quickly. But you have to do it more often. If you're using liquids, you really ought to use them every 3 or 4 weeks. When you're using the dry, it's good, you know, just do it three or four times a year, and you're in good shape. But while they're producing and you're trying to get the very most from them, I'd be doing it every couple of weeks with the liquid. And sounds like you're doing really well. I'm envious of that much fresh asparagus this early in the season.
Yeah, they're doing real good. But when it's cold, they don't produce it. If it's real cold, they don't produce it. When the sun comes out, they'll produce, you know, real good for some reason.
It's just the cold slows them down. And as the soil warms, naturally the plants are able to take up more nutrient and grow faster. So that's really not a surprise. I don't move quite as fast when the weather's cold as I do when it's warm either. And so it's not a sign of a problem. It's just it's just due to the weather and nothing else.
Yes. What other question on putting the cornmeal around the plants? He said to go, you put in a pantyhose or something and soak in water overnight and pour it around the plant. When should you put that on there? Just and how often?
Well, it depends really on your soil and your sort of your gardening history. If you've had an issue with early blight, which is where the tomatoes start yellowing and it just slowly moves up the plant, It's important to do it maybe even before you put the plants out or as soon as you put the plants out, because the way that disease gets started is when you water or the rare times that it rains, the spores for the fungus are in the soil. And that water from the sky or from your hose or whatever splashes it up onto the plants. Your cornmeal or corn water tea, either one, promote the trichoderma, which will destroy those fungal spores in the soil before they have a chance to affect your plants. So, it's never a bad time to do it. And, I very definitely would do it as soon as you've gotten your tomato plants in the ground, because the reason they call it early blight is it gets started pretty early in the season. And once it started, it's much harder to control. You can, you know, drench your plants fairly regularly. You can get it under control, but it's a whole lot easier just to prevent it in the first place.
It's better to soak it and put it under water rather than frankly just cornmeal around the plant, or?
It's faster if you soak it in the water. It activates the trichoderma more quickly. Do I do that? No, not usually, because spring is when I have very little time, or whenever there's a demand for every minute, every second of my time in the garden. And, but now the dry is faster. And if you do it at the time you're prepping your soil, a couple of weeks before you plant your plants, I think it does just as much good. But if you're putting your plants in the ground, today, then you probably ought to do the corn water tea, just because it'll be there. They'll get the trichoderma growing more quickly.
Well, I guess. Have you ever seen, a friend of mine gave me, his sister gave me some okra seed that she said was real good. And I took those okra seed they're in a pot, and he opened them up and gave them fresh. And I put those seeds in a paper towel one night, the afternoon. And the next morning, those things are already sprouting.
Wow. Well, you're early on the okra, because okra is a hot weather plant, and chilly weather will stunt it. How many plants are you going to plan on putting out? How many seed do you have?
Probably about 20.
Okay. 20. The problem is, if you put them in the ground now, that ground is still cold, and it's going to be very slow to get started, and sometimes they just don't even catch up. If it were me, I probably would go ahead and put them in pots that I can keep inside, or that I can keep a little bit warmer, normally, I mean, this is the second week of March. We don't normally leave them plant our okra seed until April or sometimes the first of May, depending on the weather. So, you just got them started really early. So keep them as warm as you can until that soil gets 10 or 20 degrees warmer.
But I've never seen them. Like, say, I just put them in that afternoon and they had that paper towel, and the next morning I looked at them and they was already sprouting.
That's the fastest I've ever heard. I've never heard of okra sprouting that fast either. So you've either got a good technique.
They already sprout coming up out of the ground.
Well, being in Corpus, you can start things a little earlier than we can. And, it may be, I don't know what your temperature is this morning. It was in, mid 40s when I left home here. And boy, that's way too cold for okra. But down there, next to that wonderful Gulf, your soil may be a little warmer. You might get away with putting them in the ground, but just, protect them from the cold winds, and, expect that they won't really start growing until that weather gets hot.
Right. Okay. Mighty fine, sir. I guess that's everything. I just wanted to kind of brief my mind on stuff. So hopefully, I've got all my tomatoes in, and I've got everything in. I've got squash in, and tomatoes, and my onions, and pinto beans. And
well, my advice to you would be get your gardening done and go fishing.
I've got everything ready in. I was going to put some, it said, soil mixture, what it is. I was going to put it around my squash and make some mounds around it where when I watered it, it would kind of make a dome around it and keep the water and fertilizer from running,
Yeah, that's what I do with mine.
Yeah, make on it. So anyway, I've still got about 15 bags of that to put out around different stuff. So, but everything's in the ground ready to go. So I was ready to set back and let it grow. So.
Well, you get out there and enjoy. You're doing a good job, Don. Keep up the good work.
Okay, mighty fine, sir. Appreciate it. Good talking to you, Don.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir. Goodbye. Ah, next in line is AJ. Good morning, AJ.
How are you percolating this morning, Bobby?
Well, you know, it's dark, and it's one of those mornings where the nice thing about radio is you only have to sound awake. You don't have to look awake. So I'm just as glad this is not an early morning TV. I have done a little bit of that, and radio's a lot more fun.
All right. Hey, on those rose cuttings, I was lucky. I got one of them that I grabbed it the other day. And
AJ, you went away there. Did you accidentally hit mute? Oh, yeah. Okay, you got one of them, and what?
Hello?
Greg, have we still got them? Are you there, AJ? AJ, I think you lost your connection. Call back, and we'll talk about the rose cutting a little more. In the meantime, let's just go ahead and go to Clint. Good morning, Clint. Okay. let me see here real quickly. It's Save? Oh, okay. Say, good morning. Good morning, Say.
Can you hear me okay?
I'm hearing you loud and clear.
Okay.
Or loudly and clearly, as my English teacher would correct me.
Oh, those darn teachers. Sometimes they come back, don't they, for years.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I woke up and at just the right time, but my list is yesterday's memory. So I'll do the best I can on a few questions. I have one little horse, and I'm going to put out some seed for him to improve his grazing on our very small acreage.
Can you keep him off this area, Faye, while the seed grows and gets started? Or is he going to be on where you put the seed in?
No, he has a pen he can be in and eat hay in the meantime.
Yeah, very good.
So how do I go about that? What kind of seed do I buy?
In being a little east of us and maybe just a little warmer and a little wetter, you could still plant some oats, which would benefit them, which would be very fast growing at this time of year. That's probably what I would suggest doing. It's a little early for any of your warm weather seed, but oats will germinate when the soil is cool, will grow quickly, and it's pretty good browse for horses, large or small. So that's probably what I would be planting right now.
Do I just buy oats feed, or do I need to order some?
No, it doesn't. It's not a legume. It doesn't have to be inoculated or anything. You can probably just get it from the feed store. Maybe even you can get a special deal on it, because normally it's planted in October or November, and you might just tell whoever is in the feed store, say, you know, it's really getting late on this stuff. I need a pretty good discount if I'm going to buy this from you. But that's going to be your best shot for getting some forage up in a hurry. Once the soil warms up, we might look at other things, but it's just not that warm yet.
What would follow then? What would you plant after that? Some kind of a wheat, or what would it be?
If you want something that is going to perennialize and be good for them right along, if you can sprig some coastal Bermuda, that's going to be what most people would graze them on. You can plant from seed. You can plant just common Bermuda. It's not going to get as tall or as heavy, but it would be nice to get some coastal started in there, and then you'd have a perennial grass that, of course, it's not going to really do a whole lot in the winter months, but it's something that you'd only have to plant once.
Okay, very good. I'll do that. And the other thing is, I'm not with any kind of a schedule, so if I could get refreshed a bit on my veggies to plant now and what to wait on a little bit.
Well, okra is one thing I would definitely wait on a little bit. Eggplant and green peppers, maybe wait on a little bit. Where you are, you probably get away with it, but now it's time to be planting tomatoes and cucumbers and squash and green beans. I like bush beans better than pole beans. Those are all things that could go into your garden this afternoon.
Good. Well, that's a little sooner on some of those than I thought. So ready to go and looking forward to a good garden this year.
Yes, you might also put black-eyed peas on the list. I love black eyes, and I'm a firm believer that they do improve your luck. So everybody should be growing at least some black-eyed peas. So, again, you're over toward Houston, so you're just a little warmer than we are, but it's a small gamble because, I mean, we have had a freeze as late as April, but it's looking less and less likely that that's going to be the case. I do recommend people setting out tomatoes right now to give them a little protection from that cold wind that's blowing this morning. Just, you know, wrap a little insulator or something around the cage just to break the wind, but I think it's time to get them in the ground.
Well, good. That makes my day to know what to pull out. I got the seeds. So I really appreciate you going over those things, and whatever else is hanging out there, I'll maybe call you tomorrow.
We're actually, they're sort of declaring a station holiday tomorrow. So, as to the best of my knowledge, we're going to do a best of show tomorrow, but I'll certainly be back here next Saturday and Sunday. And if you think of them, you can always call me back, before 9 o'clock today.
Well, thank you so much, Bob. I always appreciate what you share with me and all of us out here.
It's my pleasure, Faith. My pleasure always. Let's try AJ again. We've got that phone line corrected. You were starting to say one of your rose cuttings, AJ.
Yes, sir. One of them is tight in the perlite there. The rest of them are, they were just sticks. They didn't make it. So I'm calling for instructions on my next step.
Well, I would probably leave it in the perlite for as much as another month. This is not like rooting in water. The roots that form in the perlite are going to be exactly the same that rose bush will need in the ground. So, if anything, I'd just start mixing in a little Super Thrive or maybe a little Garrett juice, a little, Medina Has to Grow or something like that. Maybe every week when you water that, perlite, or would, you know, once a week while you're doing that. You're probably still watering the perlite every day, but about once a week or so, add just a little bit of liquid nutrient to it, and a month from now, when we know the cutting's really well rooted, it should be a nice young plant that you can transplant into soil and probably even have a bloom or two on it this spring.
All right. So, no, I've been misting them with a spray bottle, you know, about every...
Oh, better. All the better, yeah. Water. Uh-huh.
So it's okay. I'll just mix that stuff in that water and then spray it, you know, a couple hours, every hour or so. Because what's the lifespan on that Has to Grow liquid? A couple hours or 3 or 4 hours?
Oh, yeah. A couple hours would be fine. But I tell you, you're doing it a lot more often than you have to. If that's keeping you out of trouble and keeping any situations from developing, then you can spend your time doing that. But if you were doing it a couple of times a day, you would probably be doing all you need to do. And it's at some point... you know, do put it on the perlite because we want to feed the roots as well as feeding the top of the plant. But at this early stage, that foliar feeding is going to be just fine.
Okay, all righty, Bobby. You take it easy, and we'll talk to you later. Then.
Thank you. I will be here, and you do your best to avoid those situations so that it's a good weekend, AJ. Always good to hear from you, and. Next in line is going to be Ben. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
So, I've got a couple questions here.
Okay.
The first one is about grubs in my lawn.
Uh-huh.
I've got some, like, brown patches out there, and I've kind of suspected they were grubs. This is last summer, so.
Right, right.
Anyway, I guess, what would you do for treating grubs, and then how can I be sure that I have them?
If you have had grubworm damage, if you go out, is your grass St. Augustine your primary grass?
Yeah, St. Augustine.
If you go out in those areas where you have the dead spots and lift up on the grass runners, you typically will find some of them will just have no roots at all. Most of them, you know, everywhere there's what we call a node, which is where the leaf comes out, there should be a healthy set of roots, 4 to 6 roots coming down. If you've had grubworm damage, you'll find that some or all of those roots have been eaten off. And that's why it takes a little while for grubworm damage to show up. But that's the very typical sign of grub damage. Now, the grub, of course, is the larval state of the June bug, and the stage that does the most damage is what we call the first and second larval instars, and that's when the grub worms are still tiny. I mean, they're the size of a BB or barely larger. If you go digging around out there now, you might find some big grub worms, but they're way beyond their feeding stage. They're not doing any additional damage. They're just waiting for the soil to get warm enough that they can turn into a June bug and fly around and start the cycle all over again. And it's weird. I've already seen a couple of June bugs. I don't know that I've ever seen them quite this early. But if you start seeing any number of June bugs around your porch light, which is what they're attracted to at night, that's telling you that they're going to be out laying eggs in the grass, and it's time within a couple of weeks. Doesn't have to be the next day, but within a couple of weeks, I very definitely would put out some beneficial nematodes, because that's the best thing we've got going to control grubs. And you'll have the side benefit that you'll control fleas and fire ants and lots of other potentially problematic insects in the soil, but you don't hurt to put out your nematodes earlier than that. But the nematodes only live for about 60 days in the soil, and if they're not finding grub worms or something to invade and reproduce in, then their numbers may be fading before they're really needed. So I wouldn't be in any rush to put your beneficial nematodes out. Now, people planting gardens, yes, I very definitely would put down nematodes to control the wireworms, to potentially control the larval state of a number of different damaging things in the vegetable garden. But out on the lawn, June bugs are about the only thing you're really worrying about. They're grubs, and so I would tend to wait until I start seeing them before I buy the nematodes and put them out.
All right. Awesome. Thank you. And
you're certainly welcome. Yeah.
Yes, my other question involved wrinkly citrus leaves. I ended up with I had a lime tree a couple years ago, and mm-hmm. it ended up dying in that big freeze we had. But before that, I brought it in one winter for, I don't know, a week or so, because we were going to have a cold snap. And anyway, once I brought it back outside, every time it got new leaves, they always wrinkled up.
That's sort of normal. Yeah, that's almost to be expected, even if you weren't bringing it inside. When the citrus starts putting on their new growth, which they're doing now, and then we get a morning like this morning when we've got that cold wind blowing, it just dehydrates the leaves, and they get a little bit accordion-like. They're ugly, but it doesn't really hurt. They're still going to function. They're still going to be able to photosynthesize. And that's just typically something we see on citrus early in the year, every year. But it's all weather. It's not anything you're doing or failing to do.
Awesome. Sounds good. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your help.
Now, if you want to avoid the problem, just build a nice big greenhouse.
I say jokingly,
but that's going to work well the first few years. And keep in mind that limes are our least hardy of the citrus. Beyond the limes, the lemons are a little more cold hardy, and then the satsumas are really quite cold hardy. But limes are up there at the top of the list of the first ones that you're going to see suffer a little bit when we have cold wind. So you're doing it all right. Just keep doing what you're doing, and Mother Nature will warm us up, and the leaves will start normalizing before too long.
All right. Sounds good. I appreciate your help. Have a good morning.
You do the same, Ben. Thank you, sir. Goodbye. Juanita, there are only about 10 seconds here until news time, so you'll be up first when we come back from this news break. I'm Bob Webster. You're listening to Gardening, and you're doing it right here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening, and we do have some open lines, so if you're getting a busy signal earlier, it'll be a real good time to call, and you know the number, 210-599-5555. And next in line is Juanita. Good morning, Juanita.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a couple of questions. I called about 2 weeks ago. I'm a new gardener, and this has some questions I was reading. What is inoculation of the beans, like green beans, and how you go by doing it? Excuse me.
Well, beans are what we call legumes, and you don't have to inoculate them. But if you do, and you just get something that's called bean and pea inoculant, or you know some name like that. If you do, this allows them to form little nodules on the roots, which are filled with bacteria that are able to take gaseous nitrogen from the air and turn it into fertilizer. It's the whole legume group, and that includes everything from blue bonnets to vetch to clovers to beans and peas. It makes them self-fertilizing. They not only will benefit from the fertilizer you put in the soil, but they'll be making some of their own. Now, the good thing about the bacteria that do this is if you're planting your beans and peas in the same part of your garden, you only have to do it once. Those strains of bacteria that are nitrogen fixing, they will remain in the soil from year to year. Now, obviously, if you grow your big green beans on the right side of the garden this year and on the left side of the garden next year, you'll need to inoculate again just to get the nitrogen fixing bacteria into that part of your garden. But typically, and I've never found that you really need to rotate crops around in the garden. I think if you're doing it organically and have good soil, you can plant in the same place consecutive years. And so once you do it, you should be good for several years. But it's just, and the way that I inoculate is I will just wet the seeds. I'll take a cup of water or something like that with a little Garrett juice in it, throw the seeds in there, let them soak for maybe 5 minutes. You don't want to, beans and peas, you don't want to over soak them, but just get them good and wet, then just pour the water off and sprinkle some. It's like a little black, very, very fine powder. Just sprinkle a little bit of that around over it, stir it up a little bit, and they're ready to go in the ground.
Okay. All right. Activate for okra?
Mm-hmm.
To grow okra, do we need that, and where can I get it?
Well, it's harder to find. Okra is susceptible to a disease that causes some root problems called cottony root rot. And it's more common on okra than just about anything else in the garden, but I'll be honest with you, I've never had it really stunt the plants a great deal. If you can't find the actinovate, maybe just get some whole ground cornmeal or something like that and put that around the rows of your okra. Now, as I was telling a caller earlier, it's early for okra. Okra is not a warm weather plant. Okra is a hot weather plant. It comes out of Africa and in from areas where it never really gets cold. So don't be in a hurry to plant your okra. I don't normally plant okra till middle of April, sometimes even the 1st of May if the cool hangs on. But again, if you can find actinovate, that's probably the best thing out there for limiting cottony root rot. But just good old cornmeal and the trichoderma that it produces will go a long way towards stopping it.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your program every week. I have really grown a lot and have learned a lot about gardening. I really appreciate you and the audience out there.
Well,
answer
you're
a lot
very
of
kind.
Questions.
Well, and I'm always happy to be here for you, and just good to hear your voice. I hope you have a wonderful weekend and a good week, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks so much. All right, Greg, do we have anybody else waiting right now? Kim is up next. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I called a couple weeks, maybe 3 weeks ago, about my Japanese maple, and it's
right,
starting to leaf out.
Good.
One question I had is, since it's in a pot, I can put it wherever. How much light should I get? I can put it on my porch where it gets just a, you know, 2 or 3 hours of morning sun. Is that the best?
That would be fine. You just want to avoid hot afternoon sun. And this time of year, you can put it anywhere, being in a pot. And, you know, if it gets more sun, it'll come out more quickly. When we start getting up, you know, to those 90-degree days, you just don't want it to get any hot afternoon sun. You want it to have pretty bright light all the time. But your porch may be good. The shade of a tree may be a good place for it. Just kind of think about like it was you. You don't want to be out in that blistering afternoon sun. So if you would feel comfortable going outside to this spot without sunblock, then it's probably a good place for your Japanese maple.
Okay, so maybe would like 3 hours of light be enough?
I mean, oh, yeah.
Direct sun.
Okay. Yeah, it's 3 hours. Again, even if it's in the morning, direct sun is fine. But it can go with no sun at all as long as it's bright, filtered light. And what I call bright light is where it's bright enough to cast a shadow, but, you know, you're not getting the direct rays just pounding down on you. But it needs to be bright enough that it'll cast a shadow. You do that, and your Japanese maple will love it.
Okay. And I have some ground orchids that are in a spot where they get burned up every summer. In fact, last year they didn't even bloom, and I wanted to move them, but of course then they disappeared, and I'm like not sure where they are. And I bought some more and put them in one place, and they're looking good. They're coming up and they're starting to bloom, and the other ones are coming up. The first ones, the pink ones, are coming up. I want to move them with the other one to the area where the other ones I purchased. When should I do that?
Well, they tend to, you know, die back in late summer and into the fall, and that's the absolute best time to do it. They're just about to come into bloom now, so I would avoid trying to transplant them right now. If you feel like they're just going to burn in the summer, once those blooms start to fade, then go ahead and dig them and move them at that time. But the perfect time will be in September or October next fall. They're such a pretty little orchid, and they come, you know, they're the regular kind of dark purplish ones. There's a bright orchid. There's a white. There's one that even has variegated foliage, even though the flowers are normal. But that little ground orchid is called the Blatilla. And I believe in putting, you know, perhaps 1.5 to 2 inches of mulch over them in the fall. And it's just amazing. That clump will just get bigger and bigger. And that'll be one of the first things to come up and give you some beautiful color in the spring.
Okay. Two other questions about azomite. So I went to plant my tomatoes, and I went to get my rock phosphate, and I must have used it all last year. And I went to local nursery by my house, and of course they didn't have any. And he's like, oh, well, I hear you can use azomite. And I'm like, well, I already have that. So I found that I had some rock minerals from Rabbit Hill, and I had azomite, so I used that. What is the difference? I mean, I saw that the rock mineral has rock phosphate in it, but what is the difference in those? I've since then went to a different nursery and bought some rock phosphate, but most of my tomatoes were planted with out rock phosphate with the rock minerals and the
when you get just straight rock phosphate, and I think the best brand out there is Carl Poole. It's pretty finely micronized. It's a pretty fine powder, and the finer, the smaller the particle size is, the more surface area there is for the root hairs and things to interact with that mineral, so to speak, and to absorb the phosphorus. Bigger the granule, the less surface area there is. That may seem hard to comprehend, but you know, when you grind something down to a very small size, you've actually got a huge increase in the amount of surface area you have. So your plants are going to get more benefit more quickly from a powdered product like the rock phosphate than they are from a more granular form of it. I've grown up with my grandfather. We just used regular old rock phosphate and threw it in the bottom of the hole, and we grew good tomatoes. But this finely powdered stuff that Carl Poole, and there may be other companies doing it too, we've just found increases your production substantially. And whatever form of rock phosphate is going to get tied up if it gets blended into the soil. And so I would like just to put a layer of it, just a big handful of it in the bottom of the hole, set your tomato plant right on top of it, and let it grow its roots down through it. You will probably need to just read the bag of any of the other mineral supplements and see if they give you any warnings about putting it directly on the root system. If they tell you just to blend it in the soil or something like that, or if it might be harmful to the roots if they come in direct contact with it, then it wouldn't be as good. But it gives the tomatoes more benefit more quickly the more finely ground it is. I guess that's the easiest way to put it.
Yeah. I don't know. I bought whatever they had. It was Nature mm-hmm. something. And
well, you're going to grow good tomatoes. Yeah. Okay.
Then also, you've told me to use azomite to green up my kumquat. But how mm-hmm. much? Like how much? Like 2 cups? I mean, how much should I? The new growth is yellowy looking.
And refresh my memory: is it in the ground or is it in a pot?
It's in the ground. In the ground.
And how big is the plant? How tall?
Oh, it's probably 3 feet by 2.5 feet.
I would do 2 or 3 handfuls, just sprinkled on. No need to measure. It's you're not going to hurt anything with it. But I'll tell you, how about 3 handfuls if you have average-sized hands?
Okay.
And just sprinkle it on the surface of the ground. That's all you need to do.
Okay. And how often? Because this happens
usually,
green up and then get yellow again.
Probably every 6 months. If your soil is that deficient, you're not going to hurt anything with it. Azomite's a rock mineral. There's nothing in there that's going to burn or cause any problem. I mean, you can sprinkle it on every day if you wanted to, but that's way more than you need to. I would say if you have ongoing problems, I do it every 3 to 6 months.
Okay. All right, great. That's it. Thank you so much.
You are certainly welcome. You get out and have a wonderful wonderful Saturday morning. It's always good to talk to you, Kim.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, let's get a quick break in here, and then it will be James and Dolores. Right now, I get to talk about Kinetico, and I love talking about Kinetico. It's just, I think, the best water softener out there. I've had one for years. Old Brad Messer, one of my favorite talk show hosts for many years on KTSA Radio, told me that I really needed to check out Kinetico when I was looking at water softeners, and I'm glad I did. Kinetico is just different in many ways. Number one, it doesn't plug in. It runs on the kinetic energy in the water, of course, hence the name Kinetico. But this means you don't have to worry about power surges or lightning strikes and or power outages. A lot of folks, when we had the long power outages a couple of years ago, they had no soft water the whole time that was going on. The other thing is Kinetico doesn't have that built-in electronic brain that tells it when to recharge. Kinetico systems only recharge when the rosin needs to be recharged, and that's going to save you lots of salt and lots of water. Kinetico systems work just as well at producing soft water. They're very reasonably priced, and like I say, it's just sort of peace of mind. I love my Kinetico system. They're so sure you'll like yours, they'll let you try it for 90 days before you pay for it. Learn more. Head to KineticoSA.com or give them a call anytime at 210-656-PURE for Kinetico.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening on a nice Saturday morning out there. Wind seems to be dying down. I hope it's not going to be blowing too hard all day, because it's sure going to be a great day for gardening. We're going to talk to James and Dolores and Pete and John. Don't dial right this second, because every line's taken. James is first in line. Good morning, James.
Morning, Bob. How you doing there?
Off to a good start, but a little chillier out there this morning. So if I had an iron stove, I might actually have it going this morning here in the – I have plenty of iron stoves at home, but here at the nursery. I just have to put up with that central stuff. But it's a chilly morning. It was about 45 when I left home this morning. What is it at your house?
Went out earlier. It's 46, 7, something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Add that wind chill to it, and you'll want long sleeves on at least.
Yeah, man, that wind's blowing. I was fertilizing and drip watering the onion row yesterday, and those Vidalias are starting to bulb. Is that the last time we fertilize them and just let them go, or do we keep it up?
Oh, I keep on fertilizing. You know, it's just it's warming up enough that the plant's able to make those sugars and starches, which is what's making that bulb form. And if you want to get them as big as you possibly can, you know, using organic fertilizers is never going to be wasted. If the plants can't use it, it'll be bound up due to the old cation exchange capacity. So, no, I'd sure keep on fertilizing. If you stop your fertilizing, you could actually shock them enough that they would start going to bloom, and that's the last thing you want to have with happen with an onion plant, because you've got a bulb that's not going to keep real long, and it's going to not grow any bigger if it blooms. So I'd try to keep them in active growth.
Okay, then I'm doing it right.
I think you know how to do it. that's the reason everybody calls you Farmer James, because you grow more than most people do, and you've been doing it for a lot of years and doing it right. So we always are happy to hear what you're doing.
The little leaves are coming out on the oak trees and the tree pots and the in the row there, and I like to spray them with some seaweed when I get little new leaves on them. So I mixed up about 15 gallons and I was spraying seaweed on everything. And got the onions, tomatoes, trees. Are we supposed to mix something else with that seaweed or just straight out of the bottle?
I, you know, would just dilute it. I like adding a little molasses to it, but there's nothing that says you have to do it. I think everybody has their own little formula they like to do, and I like to do about 2 tablespoons seaweed to 1 tablespoon of molasses to a gallon of water, and that's what I do as a foliar spray. Now, the one thing that I think may be a good idea, we just never know what's going to happen, but it wouldn't surprise me if we have a problem with those little leaf-rolling caterpillars and the other little caterpillars that want to eat on that tender new foliage. So we're putting out a few strips of Trichogramma wasp just up and down around the oak trees. Now, pecans, it's early to be putting your Trichogramma out trying to control that nut case bearer, but our oaks or live oaks have just dropped virtually every leaf, which means there's going to be a tremendous amount of succulent new foliage out there. And I just think this is one time that prevention would be a good idea. The Trichogramma are pretty cheap, and that's one other thing I'll recommend doing this time of year is hanging out a few of them. If you got a big tree, maybe one strip per tree. If you're doing a big area, I think they say about 7 to 8 strips per acre on the Trichogramma.
Man, I wish I would have called you yesterday. I just ordered nematodes for a row that I needed to treat, and they've got the trichos also.
I'd call them back and tell them to put them in the bag along with the nematodes.
That's not a bad idea. So mix a little bit of that molasses with the seaweed.
That is what I think gives the best result. And the molasses, of course, is just a bacterial stimulant, and especially if you're putting out any BT at all, it's going to make it so much more effective. Old Barney Grimm told me that that would make your BT about 30 times more effective, so I don't know if you're putting out BT yet, but it won't be long, and that molasses is going to stay there. It's going to stay on the surface of the leaf. Some of it's going to be absorbed by the plants, and it's just one of those little extra things that doesn't cost much, and I think you get a lot of benefits from it.
All right. Hey, excuse me. The old timers say that springtime's here when the Japanese persimmon starts to bloom, and mine hasn't started to bloom yet. So,
I guess everybody has their own watchdog tree, so to speak. People used to hear people say all the time, "Oh, gotta watch the mesquites, gotta watch the mesquites." And then I saw the mesquites get fooled a couple of times. So I've always watched the pecan trees. And the pecans, I haven't really been fooled much on those, but Japanese persimmons, that'll be another good one to keep an eye on. I love those trees anyway.
I got some little, they're called fruit bags. You just tie them on the little persimmon once it makes, and then that mockingbird hasn't got a chance. He doesn't know what's going on, man.
Well, it's good to protect them. It's such a funny fruit in that while it's green and when it first starts to turn color, man, that thing is so astringent, it will pucker you for a week or two. But once it gets fully ripened, there's just not much anything better and sweeter. And we used to have a tree here at the nursery, and it finally, I think, it had a number of issues from the time we had it. But we had an older couple that had come by, and we give them the fruit, and they bring us back persimmon bread and persimmon cookies and persimmon pies. That's just a slow-growing tree, but if somebody's looking for a long-lived, easy-to-care-for fruit tree, the Japanese persimmon and any of the varieties, Fuyu, Hachiya, Tamapan, Taninashi, I think those are all great things to have around the garden.
It's a good little plant to grow. It's like going out and opening the door on the candy store, man. That stuff is really sweet.
Well, and the thing about the Japanese persimmons is because they're so astringent until they're ripe, they can't pick them early, so you don't normally see them in the grocery stores. You might find them in a farmer's market, but it's one of those fruits that it's just awfully good and awfully hard to find. And like I say, they're trouble-free trees, as I'm sure you know, and long lives. So anybody's got room for one, I highly recommend Japanese persimmon.
Yeah, they're almost as good as my homegrown tomatoes.
Two different classes of fruits. It'd be hard to compare one to the other, but they're sure both wonderful.
Hey, Bob, thanks for taking my call and answering my questions.
Always a pleasure, James. You get out and enjoy, and I know we'll talk again. Dolores and Pete and John, hang on just a second. Let's get a quick break in here. I get to talk to you about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center. And, you know, this being the 85th year that Fanix has been in business, they're celebrating with lots of good things going on. You go to the website at Fanix, F-A-N-I-C-K, FanixNursery.com to see when all their different sales and events are. But this weekend is 20% off all the Carl Pool products and all the EarthSafe products. Those are two good product lines to provide great organic products. In fact, I was just mentioning that Carl Pool powdered rock phosphate is some of the best on the market. Well, this weekend only, you're going to get 20% off over at Fanix. And while you're there, you'll see that they have the seed potatoes. They've still got onions to be set out. They've got lots of warm weather veggies ready to go in the ground, tomatoes and peppers. I think the other day they told me they have 40 different varieties of tomatoes. They've also got some new products in the Ego line. Ego, or the lithium-ion battery-powered outdoor tools that so quiet. You can be out there using them on a Sunday morning, and your neighbors won't even know what you're up to. They've got some new stuff there. They've got the Traeger pellet grills, new shipments of fruit trees and citrus, the plants that qualify for the SAW's Water Saver Rebate Program. Lots of reasons to go see our friends at Fanix. They're sitting right over there on Home Green Street, right where they've been for 85 years.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening. But first of all, that Julian's spot reminded me that Trey Ware's Drive to End Hunger is going on right now. And Trey does this every year. KTSA is just, you know, we're out there to try to make life better for everyone. And I strongly suggest that you go to KTSA.com and check it all out. And say thanks to Trey for supporting such a good cause. Let's get back to gardening here. I believe it's going to be, let me look right here. I believe it's Dolores and then John, Charlie, and Mike. Dolores is first in line. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have an interesting question, I think, concerning gardening.
Okay.
Is there any any issue with putting orange oil and vinegar on weeds where chickens feed?
I would not think so. I've certainly used it. I used to have guineas until the owls put me out of business. And if there's, I probably would spray late in the afternoon and, let it dry. But, the apple cider vinegar and all vinegars are natural products. Orange oil, you're just using a very small amount of it. So I wouldn't spray it while the chickens are out there feeding actively. I'd want to let it dry, on the weeds. But I'll ask Dr. Kirby next time I see him. But he's a big chicken lover, but I don't think there would be any problem. But you might ask your veterinarian, and like I say, I'll be talking to Dan over the weekend, and I'll get a better answer for you for that, to be just on the safe side.
Okay, so it'd be better to spray before they're out feeding and let the sun dry it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right, yeah, thank you.
Well, you're certainly welcome. And I guess you want to keep the weeds under control, but chickens like some greens in their diet, so don't kill all the weeds for them. They don't know they're weeds. They think they're something pretty good to munch on.
That's why I was asking, because I know they like to nip at them every now and then. And so I didn't want something that would be bad for them.
Better they nip on your weeds than on your garden plants, I'll just put it that way.
Yeah. Some of mine sleep in the greenhouse sometimes, and they don't bother anything.
Well, you've got very mannerly chickens then, because they
they do fertilize some.
Oh yeah. The biggest problem for me, the biggest problem in the garden when I had all the guineas, wasn't that they were eating things, but boy, they do love to scratch around. And a chicken that's out there scratching up that soil could sure pull up a tomato plant or a pepper plant or whatever else. So that is the source of more of a problem than having them eat, although they do love a red ripe tomato. So you enjoy your chickens, huh? Chickens are just special. Go ahead.
I have most of my plants in raised beds or molasses tubs, so they don't really mess too much with them.
Well, you're in great shape then. You're in great shape.
Have a wonderful day. We enjoy.
You do the same, Dolores. Thank you. Appreciate the call. Bye. Goodbye. Next in line is John dropped off, and Charlie's next. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
A few questions. For Calantia, it's blooming right now. They're in pots.
Yeah.
Best way to encourage continued blooming, once these blooms expire.
Well, Calanchos are what we call short day bloomers. They bloom when the days are short and when the nights are long. So typically, if you haven't protected from freezing weather, you're going to get a set of blooms in the fall. You're going to get a set of blooms in the spring. Now, the growers produce them year round. If you could go into a greenhouse of one of your big calancho growers, they have this automatic system where about 4 o'clock every afternoon, it automatically comes out and completely covers the bench where the calanchos are growing with black, with a black cloth. And the calancho thinks the sun has gone down early, thinks that it's either fall or spring, and they can produce blooms year round. But it's just the day length that naturally starts inhibiting blooming, and the only way that you're really going to get blooming at different times of the year or really extending the season would be to come up with a way of, sticking them in a closet every night and bringing them out the next morning, because as the days naturally lengthen, that turns off this what we call photoperiod that the calanchos are measuring to tell them when to bloom. Does that make sense?
No, yeah, it makes sense. I think I'll just enjoy the blooms in the spring and the fall.
Well, that's what I was coming to. There are lots of other fun things that will give you a world of blooms, especially through the summer months. So best enjoy your calanchos while they're in bloom, and then switch over to all those wonderful summertime flowers.
Correct. Speaking of those, When is a good time to plant, like, Salvia greggii, skullcap? I was thinking some bulbine and Mexican heather as well.
Salvia greggii, yeah, Salvia greggii and pink skullcap, you can pretty much plant those 365 days a year because those guys are cold hardy and evergreen. And the others you mentioned once again?
Bulbine and Mexican heather.
Bulbine is one that I would wait till after we're past the danger of a hard freeze because it is a little bit more succulent, and once established, it's probably going to take our winters and all. Mexican heather is the wimp of the bunch when it comes to cold weather, so I would not plant Mexican heather until we are well past the danger of any freezing weather, probably after Easter, maybe even on into the middle of April, if you want to be 100% sure. And if you want to get that one to come back year after year, mulch it pretty heavily, 2, 3, 4 inches of mulch around the base of the stems, and then it will usually come through the winter. It's just of the Cuphea's, it's the weakest one when it comes to cold. Your so-called cigar plant and most of those are going to be pretty dependably perennial. But the Mexican heather and the bat face are the two that are a little bit more tender. So just be sure you give them a little extra mulch in the fall. But nice things about Mexican heather, it'll grow and bloom in the shade better than the other ones will. And it's just a pretty plant. But like I say, it's not quite as cold hardy. So wait a little later to get it in the ground.
Okay.
Now, if you need other things to plant, we can talk about Batface Cuphea. We can talk about Giranta. I can come up with a long list of perennials you can plant in the ground right now, but just don't rush it on that one.
Yeah, okay. All right. And like just a couple callers ago, you mentioned molasses, mixing molasses, and you've in other previous shows.
Uh-huh.
What form is that molasses when you say mix it with a liquid? I'm thinking regular molasses and how well that's going to dilute.
Well, it's, you know, molasses is a sugar source. So in this case, molasses is molasses. It can be Uncle Ben's or Aunt Jemima's, or cheapest is going to be what you'll get from in a feed-grade molasses, or maybe what Medina packages. They package a very good molasses as well, but it's just the sugars in there that are going to stimulate the microbes. The one thing that to know about molasses is you see a product they call dry molasses, which is not crystalline molasses. It will not dissolve. Dry molasses is simply where they've taken a substrate like ground up corn cob or something like that and applied the molasses to it. The only advantage there is just it's easier to apply. There's no mixing. You just get out and sling it out by the handful. But on liquid molasses, go for cheap because it's all going to provide pretty much the same results.
Okay. Let's see. I had another question, but I can't think of the plant's name, so I'm not going to bother you with it. the only other thing I have is for your callers, don't forget to change your clocks this weekend.
Amen. Spring forward. I have to say about my favorite day of the year when it comes down to it, because I get an extra hour of daylight in the evening. It's dark when I go to work, regardless of whether it's daylight savings or not, but now I've got an extra hour in the garden every evening, so I'm looking forward to tomorrow. I'll happily give up an hour of sleep.
Yeah, I think they just needed decide on one and stick with it.
But, I just wish they would decide on leaving it on daylight savings year round, because it's just most of those of us who have to work but love to garden, that extra daylight in the evening's a really nice thing. So whatever, you get out and enjoy it, and give me a call whenever you have questions. You always ask good questions, and I enjoy talking to you, Charlie. We'll talk again.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. All right, Mike and Mitch, hang on just a minute. I get to talk to you for a moment about good folks over at, let me see here. Yeah, it's time to talk about Green Grow Organics and Sam Sitterly. Sam is one of the real experts in the field who's been doing this for like 35, 40 years. And his principal work is as a consultant. He's the guy that will come out to your home, look over your yard, look over your garden, talk to you about what's going right, what's going wrong, make suggestions about how to get things up to winning yard of the month every time. He's been doing it for a long time, and everything he does is 100% organic. I really like his newest program, and that is his quarterly application schedule, and they're no long-term contracts. You're not signing up for, you know, anything that you're tied to, but if you would like to get on the list, you can set it up with Sam where on a quarterly basis, he will come out and do all the necessary fertilizing. At least once a year, he'll add the mineral supplements that your plants may need, and he'll apply the beneficial nematodes as needed. Now, he still does his consulting work, but if you want an organic company that's not going to come out and pollute your landscape with poisons like the other guys do, call and talk to Sam about his quarterly program, and that way you don't have to remember to ask him to get it done. It's a great program, and I recommend it highly. Like I say, everything he does is strictly organic. You'll learn all about it if you go to greengroworganics.com, or you can always give him a call at 599-5565. Sam Sitterly, Green Grow Organics.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster, News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Mike Mitch and Kathleen. Mike's first. Good morning, Mike.
Morning, Bob. I just got one simple question. I'm having trouble getting celebrities, especially in the six packs. And it seems to me that the nurseries that deal with the Parker brothers as their growers are having the same problem. They cannot get their tomatoes in the six packs, especially the celebrities. Have you got any idea what the problem would be?
Well, I think it comes down to, you know, time versus money. The growers can pot up a 4-inch pot, you know, much faster than they can put six little plants per transplant, and they just simply make more money. There's been an increasing demand. It used to be, golly, when I first got into this business, I could not understand why anybody would buy pansies, petunias, tomatoes, peppers, and anything except six packs. But the demand is out there for 4-inch pots. People want a little bit bigger plant, and they don't seem to mind paying the extra money for it. And the growers certainly don't mind making a little bit more money when they grow it. And so it's not really greed, but we tend to carry both, but I would say that probably 80% of our customers prefer to buy the bigger plant in the 4-inch pot. Now, people who plant a lot of tomatoes or peppers or eggplant or whatever, you know, the six pack is economically is a much better buy, but it's just times are changing. It's I feel the same way about many liquid products. I never could understand why people would buy things in a ready to spray or a ready to use when they could buy a concentrate that was, you know, cost, you know, a tenth of what it does. And yet we sell 10 ready to use bottles for every one bottle of concentrate. So people are just into convenience, and the people producing, you know, all the products and all the plants are growing what people are demanding. And if more people, you know, insisted on six packs, we probably would see more of them in the marketplace.
Okay, well, see, I got the tycoons, and I got the big boys and the better boys and the early girls and whatnot. I got them in six packs. That's fine, but I cannot get the celebrities. And what I like to do is, you know, get my six packs and then transplant them into 1-gallon containers, you know, and let them and keep them out of the weather, you know, whenever it's going to freeze or whatever, so I can move them inside so they won't freeze. And I'm not going to plant them. And I'm not going to plant them until, you know, 2 or 3 weeks from now. But anyway, that's what I like to do.
Yeah, and I 100% understand what you're saying. And it's just a matter we're having to go as far as Arkansas to get, you know, decent quality vegetables. Just nobody's growing enough of them. And it won't be long probably before we'll have to switch over to our Denver supplier to get them, and they'll grow them in 4-packs for us. But we're looking, and just keep asking. I don't know if there's a specific problem with celebrities, but You know, you might, have you ever grown tomatoes from seed? It's not all that difficult. You might try growing your own six pack sometime.
Yeah, I've done that, and it's been limited success. But anyway, I've done that. But isn't Parker Brothers, aren't they local? I mean, aren't they in San Antonio?
Peterson Brothers is local.
Peterson. That's what I'm talking about.
They've had an ownership change, and I think they're still trying to kind of find their way along. But they've had ownership, and also some of their longtime staff over there is gone on to do different things. So they're feeling their way along is the best way I can put it.
Well, do you have any celebrities in the six packs? I haven't checked with the shades of green.
I would have to call a little later and go out and look. Our inventory changes very greatly from 9 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. In fact, the guys are out front unloading 125 cases of things off a California truck as we speak. So it changes so quickly. But I'll tell you what, if you can always call, and if we do, you can say, hey, put my name on them, and I'll be by a little later, and that way they'll still be here when you get here. But we have chefs that come in and buy, a whole 18-flat thing of herbs, and, we can start out early in the morning with 6 flats of basil, and by, 2 hours later, there's none out there. So it's spring in the nursery business, and we're all doing the best we can. But I'll keep an eye out for celebrity six packs. But we'll just hope for the best, and hopefully Peterson will get back to producing more of them in the future.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Bob. I appreciate it.
Well, hopefully a little better understanding there. And Mike, and let's see, we've only got about 45 seconds till news here. So Mitch and Kathleen, hang on. With this wind out there, anybody who's put your tomatoes out in the garden, I know a lot of people have, anything you can do to keep this cold wind off of them is going to be greatly appreciated by the plants. What I do, and I don't have tomatoes in the ground yet, but what I do when I do is go ahead and put my tomato cage down over the plants, even though they're very small, and then I will cut a strip of insulate, the white roll cover fabric, and I know we talk about using it for frost protection, but I'll cut it and just wrap it around the tomato cage, hold it in place with clothespins. That cuts down on the wind and really helps things off to a good start. And if it gets real cold, just put a little flap over the top. Right back after news here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
Back to gardening on, it's still windy out there, but it's not going to be a bad day. You're going to be wearing a light jacket and long pants, unlike the shorts and t-shirts we had earlier in the week, but it's going to be a great day for gardening. Looks like Mitch dropped off, and he was the one that was going to be up first, but now it's Kathleen, and then it will be John and Daniel. Good morning to Kathleen.
Hey, Bob. I had a question. I've got a lemon tree from a transplant, and it's about 4 years old.
Okay.
It's really, I don't know how to prune it.
Well, there's no need to prune it. You know, some fruit trees like peaches and plums, we have to prune those to maintain the vigor of the tree and to get good fruit. But lemons, there's absolutely, the only reason you prune a lemon is to change the shape of it, or keep it from getting so big, or perhaps make it more tree-like. But there's nothing that mandates pruning. You're not making a healthier tree if you do that. If you do need to prune, I like to do it while it's in bloom in the spring. And the reason is very simple, because when it's got the blooms on it, I can see which limbs are going to have the fewest fruit, because ones that have the fewest blooms, I can see which limbs are going to have the most fruit because they have the most blooms, and naturally I'm going to prune out the sections that don't look like they're going to make as much fruit this year. But again,
well, it's still young, so I haven't gotten any blooms. You know, it's 4 years old, so doesn't it take like 4 to 6, 5 to 6 years or something?
That's only if it's grown from a seed. A grafted
lemon. Okay, well, that's what it was.
Oh, okay. Well, you may have another 2 or 3 years to wait, but if you're as impatient as I would be, go out and get a grafted one or a cutting-grown one, because they can have fruit the first year.
Wow. Well, it's too late now, Bob.
Well,
I'm not getting another one.
There's no such thing as too many lemons.
Yeah, well, that's true, but I live in an RV and have a big deck, but, you know, I don't have tons of room, so.
Well, just be patient with it. You can't speed up that maturation process, and kind of like an animal.
Yeah,
it has nothing.
Think I could.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with size. It's just physiological maturity, and your lemon will get there, so go ahead and prune it any time of year if you feel like you need to control its size or its shape so that it travels with you better.
Yeah, it just, well, we don't travel. Our RV is put, set,
okay.
It's put for life. But it's just that the lemon tree is kind of lanky, and which is fine, but there's like one branch that's going off to the side and drooping down. And
oh, well, so cut it back today.
Okay.
Yeah. Cut it back today. Wherever you cut it back to, it will branch out from that point. And since at this stage of its life, we're not worried about buds or blooms, you do it when it's convenient for you. Now would probably be the best time of year.
Okay. And then one more question. I bought several succulents, and I don't know the name of this cactus, but it's a smooth bottom, and then it has a, you know, little bulbs of color on it, the top.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anyway, it kind of broke off, and I'm going to put it in a planter. Do I just stick that whole broken piece down in the dirt? Is that what I do?
What you have is a grafted cactus. It's two different plants, actually, and it is a cactus than a euphorbia. But hopefully you have at least a little bit of that green trunk that it was on.
Oh, yeah, I do. I have quite a bit.
Yeah, just use a couple of chopsticks or something to prop it upright. Put that stem not deeply into the soil, because if it stays too wet, it will rot. So just maybe a quarter of an inch down into the soil with a couple of little stakes to hold it in place, and water, you know, as you normally would. Don't keep it too wet. But missed it every now and then. It's lost its root system, so you don't want it to shrivel and dehydrate. And that little colorful top that's grafted onto it, the separate plant, doesn't have much chlorophyll, so it's not doing a whole lot to contribute to the plant's strength and growth. So missed a little every now and then with a little fertilizer, as well as watering the soil properly. It should take root. You can keep the bottom part, and it will continue to grow. It'll just be a green cactus. You can consider, you know, grafting it at some point if you want, but you've now just got three plants instead of two, so to speak. You've got one grafted one, and then you've got the rootstock that it was grafted onto. So keep up the good work and give it plenty of sunshine and enjoy it for a long time.
Yeah, it didn't totally break off. It's just like one part of it at the bottom just sort of is separated from the main part, so it's not totally off. So
okay, well, the part that has the and a lot of times they call them oriental moon cactus and things like that, keep it. If it's just, you know, cracked but not completely broken, you can kind of prop it up. The whole thing is just don't let it move around too much while it heals, because like a broken bone, it does have at least some capacity. And it may need to stay propped up for a long time, but as long as it has some of that vascular system still intact, both top and bottom should stay healthy.
Okay, that sounds good, Bob. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
You do the same.
We'll miss you tomorrow.
Well, it's, you know, just got some folks at the station, got some things they need to do, and we'll have a good best of show for you.
Good. Okay. Well, we'll talk to you next weekend.
Look forward to it, Kathleen. Thank you.
Okay. Good. Bye-bye.
All right. John is next in line. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I had some old seeds, tomato seeds, and I planted them to see what would happen. They're actually from, it says, sell by 12/17. So these were old.
Uh-huh.
And I just happened to put them in. I'm down here in Pleasanton and Sand, and they're growing. And
good.
It's a San Marzano
Yeah, and yeah, it's an Italian paste tomato. That one's a good one.
And a Rio Grande.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that one, but San Marzano's variety has been around for many years. But well, you've done well. Not everybody gets germination out of older seed like that, but tomato seed can stay viable a long time. What can I tell you about it?
Here's my question is, they're growing really close together, and I'm in sand. They're about 3 inches tall because I just put them in the ground. I bought some that were already grown tomatoes that I have in cages. Those are about 6 or 8 inches tall, and I have them all spaced out and ready to go, and they're growing. So when I go to transplant these, I have a feeling the sand's going to completely fall away from the root. You know, I might have like almost a bare root kind of tomato plant. Can I bury them all the way up to where the leaves are?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if they're even bigger, you can pinch off the lower leaves and bury them. I would leave at least 2 or 3 sets of good leaves on them. But no harm at all in planting them. The tomato plant's the one plant that we can plant more deeply that way. But, and as long as you replant immediately, bare rooting, that's going to happen when you're, you know, taking them out of seed trays anyway. So, if you want to leave them, I think it's fine to have 2 tomatoes growing closely together. In fact, that's what I do. And, you know, I use a big wider tomato cage and I always put 2 plants in there instead of 1. So if when you go through transplanting, if you want to leave groups of 2 plants there, I don't see anything wrong with that. But any more than 2 close together, that would crowd them. So I would transplant those away.
Okay. And then I picked up some Alaskan, I think it's fish fertilizer.
Okay.
And molasses, and I mix them. I forget if you promote that stuff or not. And I'm feeding them. I'm not pouring them over the plant. I'm pouring them at the base of the plants.
That's the best way to do it. Are they doing well for you?
Oh yeah. Yeah. You know, I did it last weekend, and I think you do it every other week.
That's what I would recommend. My only problem with the fish-based fertilizers, and they are excellent products. I love the new Medina Fish Blend. I think that's outstanding. Alaska's a pretty good one. But one thing about it, it is more attractive to raccoons. So if you're in an area and you use very much fish fertilizer, you may find the raccoons in the garden digging the plants up thinking there's a dead fish down there. So that's the only negative to it, is it is much more attractive to some of the varmints out there. But if you've got those under control, excellent product.
Well, I have raccoons. I just saw one last night while I was looking out my window.
Well,
how soon?
Go ahead.
Might have to switch products, right?
Well, that or I would tend to transport the raccoons elsewhere. But go ahead with the other question.
If I keep my grass clippings, how long can I till I can use them? Because I know they can get hot.
If you put them
in a pile.
And that's a great observation, because they need to be beyond that heat-producing stage. Because while that active decomposition is going on, you could use them as a mulch, but you don't want to really work them into the soil. But when they stop generating that heat, that tells you they're broken down far enough to use like you would compost.
Okay, so these peas that I worry about, I can catch my clippings and just grab handfuls and put them at the base of the peas right away. And as long as it's only 1 or 2 thick, they'll be okay.
Again, that'll be a mulch. Yeah, as long as you're not working it into the soil. As a mulch on the surface, that's going to be fine. If it gets to the point where it mats up to where the water's not going through the clippings and getting the soil underneath, then, you know, that's too much. That's when you might want to blend in a little bit of finished compost or chopped up leaves or something just other than grass clippings. But sometimes those grass clippings can mat together and almost make a waterproof layer. That's what you want to avoid.
Well, I found the hard way with the sand, if you don't double water, sometimes you can actually create like 1/4 inch. It almost turns into cement, and the water doesn't go through the sand, which is interesting.
Sand plus clay equals cement. If you're using lava sand or a more coarse sand, you won't have that much of a problem. But fine sand plus plus clay. Again, that's basically is cement. So not a good thing to do. I never recommend mixing fine sand or play sand into the soil. If you want to loosen the soil, compost is a better product. If you want to use a sand product, get the coarser sands like granite sand or better still, lava sand.
Now, if the weeds are included in the grass clippings, does that cause problems?
It's quite possible that you get some weed seed, which will germinate and grow, but you're probably going to get some weed seed anyway, just because it's blowing around out there in the wind today. But my old friend Alton Grimm, one of my wonderful mentors over the years, used to say, I would worry about soil that didn't have any weeds in it because there's something wrong with it. It just means you may have to spend a little more time with your push-pull hoe or down on your hands and knees pulling, but not a problem.
Okay, thanks. Thank you, Bob.
Good question, Sean. Thank you for the call this morning. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
All right, Daniel, hang on just a minute. And Alonzo and Tana, let me get a break in here. Looks like I get to talk to you about a wonderful line of products called Nature's Creation. Nature's Creation, oh, they package everything from fungicide cornmeal to green sand to great soil products from garden soil to landscape soil to mulches to good compost. They also make fertilizers, and one of their fertilizer products is called Turf Food. It's a 422 formulation based on pasteurized poultry manure, and that's one they want me to talk about today. The thing about this one is that they have really fortified it with mycorrhizal fungi, several different strains of mycorrhizae in there. I think six different strains they add to it, and that, of course, is going to benefit the growth of just about anything you put it on. Handful of plants out there like broccoli and a couple others, they don't associate with a mycorrhizal fungi, but most everything in your garden, well, it will really appreciate it. And their 422 blend, again, no biosolids, based on poultry manure, a really good product. We love all of their products. It's just a good company, and you'll find, well, products specifically like this you will find at Earthworks over in Victoria, at Naylor's down in Corpus Christi, Friendly Natives up in Fredericksburg, Fanix here in San Antonio. Many other nurseries carry fine products from Nature's Creation.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, looks like it's going to be Daniel, Alonzo, Tana, and Cindy. Daniel's first in line. Good morning, Daniel.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
I've got a pecan question.
Okay.
I live on top of a hill out by Helotes. Mm-hmm. I tried several times to get pecan trees to grow, and amazingly, I got one to grow.
Okay.
I bought it at one of the box stores. So The 7 years that it's been growing, it has never bloomed. Does it need some kind of fertilizer, or is it just not the right kind?
Well, your problem is not so much the kind of tree, it's the kind of soil. And where you are, you tend to have pretty shallow soil. And pecans, it's not truly a taproot. But a pecan's going to be happiest if it has 6 or 8 feet of soil to grow in, and you're probably doing very well to have 6 or 8 inches of soil to grow in. So not a lot you can do. I mean, you can't very well dig it and replant it, and you certainly can't pile soil up around the trunk. So best thing is you should fertilize several times a year. You don't want it right up against the trunk, but you want a heavy mulch around the tree, you know, from 6 inches away from the trunk out, maybe 10 feet in all directions, because since you can't improve the soil from the bottom up, you've got to do your best to get it from the top down. But if you ever plant another one, you really ought to be creating either a giant berm to plant it in, or, you know, a really high raised bed, because I know on my own ranch, you know, pecans that I have where the soil's more shallow, they are a third the size of some of the ones that are, you know, down in the alluvial soil around my creek, some of which have been there for a couple of hundred years, judging from the size of them. But pecan tree is just a tough tree to grow where you don't have deep soil. Now, there are not male plants and female plants, so to speak, but they are divided into two groups, protogynous and protandrous. Not that you need to know those words, but some pecan trees produce pollen first. Other pecan trees produce the female, the little nutlet first, even though both trees are going to have, you know, the same, and you're going to get some pollination anyway. But if you were a commercial pecan grower, you would want to get one of the varieties that releases the pollen first and one of the varieties that forms the nutlet first to get maximum nut production. But you're not dealing with anything you're doing wrong, except that you're in an area where the soil's not as deep as a pecan tree would really like. Does that make sense?
Yes. I used a backhoe to dig the hole, and I actually hit black dirt, so I was amazed.
Well, but, as long as the hole drains.
Next question.
Okay, go ahead.
How about grafting? Could I graft two different kinds of wood onto the same tree?
Absolutely. In fact, 100 years ago, they grafted pecans onto hickory and hickory onto pecans, and they do budding rather than grafting on a pecan, but either way will work just fine.
Would you have a suggestion of what would be the best two kinds to do together?
One of the, probably the most productive pecan tree in the area is a variety called Desirable, and it's going to be a heavy producer most years. Probably my second favorite one would probably be Mohawk, which is a little bit more compact tree but a heavy producer. After that, we'd be looking at things like Cheyenne and Choctaw. The one you want to stay away from is Wichita. That one is much more susceptible to some disease issues. But if I were going to do some additional grafting, I would almost certainly do Desirable. And then I'd probably make Mohawk my second variety.
Okay, and that one blooms first or puts the pollen off?
I'm going to have to get out one of those fruit tree guides. It's one of the things that I is not committed enough to memory to tell you which are the protogynous and protandrous varieties. But if you called over to Fanix and asked for either Mark or Mike, they probably have one of those guides right by the telephone, and they can tell you. And they're probably also one of the best places as far as pecan trees go. Otherwise, it's going to be, well, I don't know. They might even let you have a little bit of graft wood. If you're budding, it's important that you keep your bud wood chilled a little bit later. You let the sap rise in the tree you're going to bud onto, and then put a dormant bud on there, and it takes a whole lot better. But get a good pamphlet, or you can probably go online. Just be sure it's a website for this area. I'm not sure how much dirtdoctor.com has on grafting. I'll ask Howard that when we visit about 8 o'clock. But it's not difficult, but there are a few little tricks to know, like taking your budwood early and keeping it in the refrigerator for a while.
Yeah, I had some good mentors like you, Buddy Deckert and Marvin Nepkin, and Alton Grimm. I knew all three of them, so I've done some pecan trees in the past.
Well, I worked with Alton for a couple of years when I first moved down to this part of the country, and he's one of the finest men, as one of the best nurserymen I've ever known. So you did have some good mentors along the way. Sadly, they didn't stay around long enough.
Yep. I didn't listen well enough either.
Takes a good man to admit that.
Well, thank you very much, Bob.
You're sure welcome. Good to talk to you. Let's go ahead and talk to, Alonzo and Tana and Cindy. Hang on just a minute, because I'm right up to time to do another commercial. And it looks like I get to talk to you about this company called Aqualock, which I always enjoy talking about new companies with new products, especially local veteran-owned companies. And these guys are up in the big city of Bernie, which I happen to be pretty familiar with. And they've just got a couple of great new products out there. The company is called Aqualock, and they make a number of different products, but the two that they really want me to talk about, one of them is called Supercast, and Supercast are some of the best quality worm castings, earthworm castings that you will find is the base for it. They've fortified that with all sorts of biostimulants, and then they've added their hydrogel, their material that actually goes in the soil that attracts and holds water. Now, you have to blend it into the soil, but it will really cut down how often you have to water in the summer months. Breaks down slowly over about a year and a half. It's not something you can put in the soil to stay there forever. But if you're growing pots and hanging baskets and things through the summer and don't want to have to water quite as often, this is a great way to go. Now, if you're just looking for the gel by itself, they call that product TerraLock. And it can be blended into garden soil. It can be mixed with potting soil. Lots of different ways to use it. And once again, it's a product that's based, it's like 99% natural based out of all things, things like bananas. And it's a natural way to hold extra moisture. It also tends to hold the nutrients in the soil until the plants are ready to use them. A great company, great new products. You'll find these products. I know they have them at Rainbow Gardens. We have them here at Shades of Green. I suspect you'll find them on the shelves of most nurseries before too long. Fine products from Aqualock.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. It's going to be Alonzo, Tana, Cindy, and Travis. Alonzo is next in line. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have a few questions for you. I'm going to try to make it quick.
Okay.
Well, the first one is, I this past fall, I threw out some bluebonnet seeds. I didn't actually plant them, kind of tossed them out, watered them down.
That's the way you do it. That's how Mother Nature does it. Well, and, go ahead.
I see, like on the in the median between the highways, that they're already blooming. I'm not getting those results at my place, and just wondering: are they going to bloom later on? Are they a late bloomer? I know.
Are you seeing little plants? Are you seeing a little rosette of leaves and just not have flowers yet? Or do you not see anything at all?
I don't see anything at all. Not unless I'm looking for the wrong thing. I mean, looking at the wrong thing, but I don't see anything as far as what looks like should be bluebonnets.
Well, they have to go through two growing cycles. The first cycle produces this little thing they call a rosette. And the leaves will be, they'll almost look gray in color. They're covered by very fine hairs. And they spread out. They'll normally be 3 or 4 inches in diameter. And then a little bit later in the season, they start, you know, putting up that bloom spike, which is what we see. What was your seed source? Where did you get your seed?
From a nursery out of Victoria. I can't remember the exact name of it, but it is from a nursery, not from a box store.
Did you scarify the seed, or did you treat the seed in any way before you threw it out?
No, I just tossed them out there, Bob.
Okay. Mother Nature really protects the bluebonnet seed. She like encases them almost in concrete so they can lie there for 10 years until the weather or whatever is just right, or, you know, freeze and thaw and things like that gradually soften the outer covering of the seed. And my suspicion is that the seed you got was a little bit older, and that doesn't mean it's bad seed, but it means that it may take a year or two or three before, you know, it germinates and sprouts. When you get bluebonnet seed, unless you know that it's really fresh seed, you really ought to probably soak it in Garrett juice. Lots of people will like put them between two sheets of very fine sandpaper and just, you know, scratch them real hard, because that kind of abrades that waxy coating, which lets the seed absorb the moisture and germinate much more quickly. So I think if you did nothing, and if we hadn't had this talk, you would be sitting there looking at not much this year, and then all of a sudden you'd have some next year, and the following year you'd have more, and the year after that you would have more and more.
Yeah.
The seeds that you, or the plants that you see up and blooming now, are probably very fresh seed. They're probably seed that fell from that plant last June or July, and that seed hasn't really hardened, And super fresh seed like that is always going to be the first to sprout and grow. And where you see those plants in bloom right now, if you got down on your hands and knees and really searched, you would find plenty of older seed lying around there too. And that's Mother Nature's insurance in case we had a grass fire, in case we had just horrible weather, or we had a 7-year drought, heaven forbid, or something like that. There would still be bluebonnet seeds that would come up and grow. But I don't think it's anything you failed to do. I think you just got a little bit older seed. If you do that again, do scarify it, do soak it in Garrett juice before you put it out, and you'll have more of them. You're never going to have 100% of them germinate, but germinate in 1 year. But on the other hand, you will have additional plants come up year after year. They've just been sitting there waiting.
Okay. And would I do the same thing also with the Pride of
Barbados? Pride of Barbados.
Would I do the same thing with that?
Absolutely. That is the hardest seed out there. You don't have to actually saw a hole in the side of it. You just have to scratch it. Imagine it had a layer of hard wax on it, and you've got to scratch it up enough to make enough of a dent in that wax that the seed can absorb moisture, which is what it's going to take for it to sprout and grow. Again, I think about a Pride of Barbados in my own backyard that probably produces, 500 seed or more every year. And yet I only have, 8 or 10 little seedlings managed to come up, but they'll be coming up for the next 20 years. So if you want a lot of, a high percentage of germination, shall we say, yes, you should scarify those seeds for sure. Scratch them lightly, and the way the professionals do it, you know what a gym tumbler is? They throw the rocks in and they tumble them to get them real shiny and everything. Professionals will have something like a gym tumbler. They'll throw that in, and then they'll throw in a little bit of lava sand or a little bit of a carborundum or something like that, and they'll just set that thing and keep spinning them for 2 or 3 hours, making sure they're good and scratched, and then they'll get basically 100% germination the first year. That's these folks that where you see the little trays of bluebonnets in the nurseries, that's probably how they treated their seed to get them started.
Okay, and so if I want, say, an abundance of, because I want to plant three sections, mm-hmm. of that type of plants. So how many would you recommend as far as like maybe 6 to one section and 6 to the other, or does it matter? Or does one produce a lot, or does that need?
Each seed makes basically one relatively small plant. Talking to John Thomas, the man who owns Wild Seed Farms, the biggest wildflower seed company in the world, he told me one time, he said, when we're harvesting seed from a field of bluebonnets, we get about 400 pounds per acre, and we think we're getting about a third of the seed. So Mother Nature's planting, 1,200 seed per acre. So you just have to judge how big are your different plots that you want to plant.
Right now I haven't even started them, Bob, but what I want to do is plant them in the ground because I'm sure, mm-hmm. Do I need to start them in a pot? Let me ask you that.
You could if you wanted to, but you don't have to. But if I had, say, a 5x5 patch, I'd put 10 or 15 seeds in there. If I had a 10x10 patch, I'd probably put 30 or 40 seeds in there. Because even scarifying, not 100% of them are going to sprout and grow the first year. And with, right now it's not looking real good for rainfall. So we may be in drought restrictions. You may be limited to how much you can water them. So going to have a pretty fair amount of seed out there. Unfortunately, we used to be able to get bluebonnet seed by the pound, and it wasn't too bad, maybe $20 a pound or something like that. Yeah. Now they're not putting it in anything more than those tiny little packages that are fairly expensive. You might check down. There's a great guy with a great company called David's Garden Seed. He's down just a little way south of San Antonio, and he'll ship it to your doorstep. But you might call him and ask him if it's possible to get a bigger package of seed, because he packages all the seed right there on site. And he's down toward Pleasant.
What was his name again?
David's Garden Seed.
David's Garden Seed, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and one more quick question, Bob. My wife has a peach tree, and it has flowers on it, and it's blooming, the little red ones, I guess, what they are.
Yeah.
are those going to be turned into pizzas? Because we had that happen last year, but they never really came to, to be, you know, peaches. They just kind of grew about maybe an inch in diameter, and then that was it, you know.
Have you pruned your trees? Have you thinned the trees out this year?
No, sir.
Every year on a peach tree, you go through, you're not really pruning, you're going through and thinning out the productive wood. And think of it this way, if that peach tree was capable of making 50 pounds of fruit, you thin it out properly, you would have 50 fruit that weigh a pound apiece. You don't thin it out, you'll have 500 peaches, but they'll only get as big as a golf ball or maybe even smaller. So peaches and plums are two trees that, and you can do it right now while they're in bloom, but go through, go up and down and take out every other little, you know, side growth coming out on the limbs, because you've got to thin peaches pretty heavily by close to 50%. Plums, maybe even a little bit more to get good production from them.
Okay, so do I cut the ones that are blooming or not the ones that are not blooming?
I would tend to, I would look at the, I would definitely leave ones that have either big buds or blooms. I probably would do some of both. Okay. Because we don't know what the next 3 weeks are going to be. We don't know what the insect activity is going to be like, because you do have to have pollination to get the fruit produced.
Okay. All right. Well, appreciate it, Bob. By the way, our red oak is blooming. I asked you that question last
yeah.
week.
Yeah.
We were kind of worried that they were hurt by the freeze, but
right.
they're alive and kicking.
That's a good thing. Glad to hear it. You get out and have a great weekend. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome. All right, got to get a break in here. Then Tana and Cindy and Travis will be up next. I get to talk to you about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, and that's just one of my favorite things to do because they are such a good company. I mean, there are lots and lots of roofers out there, most of them dealing with old shingle roofs, and they're going to tell you, oh, the heat hurts your roof, the cold hurts your roof, the hail hurts your roof. There are many, many reasons they want to talk you into letting them put a new roof on. Well, with Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, their motto is do it once, do it for life. They put on a roof that is meant to last a lifetime. They do new construction as well as roof replacement. And I should know, they put the roof on my home probably 20 years ago and never had one single problem with it. Same thing's true here at the nursery, and so many people that I've recommended Southwest Metal Roofing Systems to, they take the time to call me back and tell me what a beautiful roof they got and how much they absolutely love it. Prices are very reasonable, especially considering that roof's going to be there forever. And you're going to find they're energy efficient. They save you money on your utility bill every month. Many insurance companies will give you a discount when you have a Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roof on your home, because they know they're not going to have to answer a lot of claims on those roofs. They also look good. There are a lot of choices in different styles and even different colors. I recommend them very, very highly. And if you would like to learn more about them, just give them a call, 210-822-6868. Gosh, it's been about 3 days since the last time I called them to get some different information and things. But 210-822-6868 for Southwest Metal Roofing Systems.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, quickly back to the phone lines. Going to try and get Tana and Cindy and Travis in here before our next break. Good morning, Tana.
Hey, good morning, sir.
Well,
I started out with one question. Now I have two.
Okay.
Okay, the first one is I have a two-year-old Meyer's lemon.
Mm-hmm.
And when you buy them, they're already made like a tree.
Right.
Is it possible that I will get branches out along the trunk later on and it will make itself into a bush, or do I just have a nice little tree?
Well, you can take and just pinch off the upper half inch of that trunk, and that will make it put out more branches along the trunk. If you want existing branches to branch, you know, I wouldn't do any major pruning on it, but if you just kind of pinch off that last half inch, it will force buds to break up and down the trunk and up and down the stem, and won't really reduce any potential production, but it will very definitely make it a fuller, bushier tree.
Oh, okay. And the second is regarding earthworms.
Mm-hmm.
If I go to Walmart and buy some red wigglers,
mm-hmm.
will they live?
They will live at least for a while. There are other varieties. I listened to a fascinating book called The Earth Moved by a lady named Amy Stewart. If you want to learn more than you ever knew about earthworms, get it as an audio book or as one you can read. But there are other worms that you could probably order online that would do a better job in your soil. But those red wigglers, they're going to do okay. They're all right to improve your garden soil. But there are a lot of different earthworm varieties you could potentially use.
Okay, so if I got them, then a number of them would probably die, but some of them would hopefully reproduce.
Sure. Yeah, and put out some coffee grounds, put out some good compost and things. In effect, feed your earthworms. They love Medina's fertilizer. I can tell you that because everywhere I put it on top of the soil, when I go back to dig, I find a ton of earthworms underneath it.
Okay, well, I use the Medina Has to Grow.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm talking about the granular.
Oh,
get a little bag of the growing green and throw some of that out, too.
Yeah, I have a bag of growing green, too. Okay, so that will encourage them. I thank you very much, sir.
I thank you for being very punctual. And Cindy, good morning. It's your turn.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I have a question regarding Johnson grass. I heard you have said in the past that if you just keep it cut short, you can kind of kill it off. Is that correct?
That is correct. It has to grow tall to survive. And if you mow it weekly, pretty soon you'll have none of it.
Is that because you're cutting off the photosynthesis of it?
In part, yes. You're cutting off the photosynthesis. You're not allowing it to make the tender new tissue, which is the most effective as far as capturing the sun's issue. As the tissue ages, even the green part doesn't photosynthesize as well. So basically, yes, that's what you're doing, is reducing the photosynthesis. But there are a number of different things you're doing by cutting it back. It's not simply making less green tissue.
Okay. Because I was wondering if that would hold true for nutsedge. I'm battling nutsedge, and
I wish it would.
I am digging up the little nodes, but I'm wondering if I can just cut off the photosynthesis.
No,
that's what feeds it.
It is, but it's the nutsedge has the ability to hold so much nutrient in its system. You can greatly limit it. I eliminated nutsedge from a rose bed one time years ago by mulching it very heavily, putting about 2 inches of mulch over the top, which in effect cut off a lot of the photosynthesis. And it's like the little plants migrated upwards in the soil. All of a sudden, I got to where when I grabbed that little top and lifted it up, it would come up and I'd get like 6 plants around it. And I did that about once a week, and over the period of about 4 months, I totally eliminated, you know, the nutsedge from that bed. But it wasn't, okay. it didn't die out. It just forced it into a place, so to speak, that I could pull it up much more effectively. But just trying to cut it off, no. It's basically an aquatic plant, and it has the potential for storing so much energy. You could cut it back 50 times, and it would still manage to come back again.
Okay. My other quick question is what is your favorite bush bean variety?
In early spring, it is Tavera, Tavera. In midsummer, it's Contender, Contender. The Tavera, Tavera, that is the most productive bean I've ever had, but you need to put it in before it gets too hot.
Is that seed pretty easily available?
Should be. Just about anybody has packaged seed should have it.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for answering my questions.
That's what I'm here for. I appreciate the call, and let's get Travis in here. Got a little over 2 minutes left. Travis, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, sir?
Good.
I have a quick question, a tree question. So
okay.
I live just north of Burney, a few miles, and last year, I went to Home Depot, and they had a Mexican wind palm tree. Mm-hmm. And I planted it in the ground last year. It did really, really good. It put off new palm leaves. It was growing really good. And then this freeze we had a month or two ago, it died, and I had watered it, and it died. So I was wondering, can they grow here? Is there something I did wrong?
It's a bad tree. It's a tree that would be great for you in South San Antonio, but it is not cold hardy enough. There are palms you can grow. One of the hardiest ones, if you want a bushy palm, is called a sable, S-A-B-A-L palm. If you want a taller one, there's a variety called a windmill palm, W-I-N-D-M-I-L-L. But the Mexican fan palms are two different species of Washingtonia, Robusta and Filifera. One of them is more cold hardy, but if you're north of San Antonio very far, especially north of Bernie, they're going to freeze. And the only living part of that palm, so to speak, is right up there where the fronds come out of the top. If that little 1-inch section freezes, the plant is dead. It will not sprout up from the base. And hate to tell you that, but you just simply got the wrong variety. You live in a beautiful area. I live north of, well, I live west of Bernie, but you sure can't grow Washingtonia palms, Mexican fan palms up there.
Yes, sir. And I've heard some people, where they wrap them, is that something that's possible, or just get a different type?
Get a different type. If you can wrap that top part, that would work, but you'd have to cut all the fronds off to wrap it properly. And most of the Washingtonia types can easily get 15, 20 feet tall, and you don't want to be up there in a cold wind trying to wrap it. Just get a different variety, like sable or the windmill. Those will be two good varieties for you. We can talk more another time. This is KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
And it is a very good morning, but don't dial right this minute, because we'll save approximately the last 30 minutes of the show for a few more phone calls. But this is the time of day on Saturdays that we get to visit with the Dirt Doctor, and I get to say good morning, Howard Garrett.
Greetings, everyone. A little coolish there.
It's just a reminder that it's only the second week of March when it gets up to 75 and 80 degrees. I don't know about Dallasites, but South Texans seem to assume that that winter has ended, and they put away their warm clothes and want to plant things that they shouldn't be planting yet. And anyway, it's been a beautiful week, but we're chilly and windy down here. It was in the low or mid 40s when I left home this morning, and I just felt sorry for all those little tomato plants out there that people haven't properly protected from the wind.
Yeah, the wind's the worst thing. It's going to make those cool season things last a little longer. All my good ideas about planting those cool season flowers, stock and pansies, and various other things that I stuck in the ground kind of late in the season are going to last a little longer now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's and several of those things, even though they're sold as annuals, you know, I've had that stock come back for as much as 3 years, and things like dianthus, especially some of the taller varieties like First Love, those frequently last 2 or 3 years, and there's no excuse for having a drab landscape. They're things you can put out there. You should have blooms 365 days a year.
Yeah, I put out quite a few of the dianthus myself, so it's going to look good for a while. It may fool us. I mean, we may look up one day and it's back up to 95 again, but they can last. I've got a bunch of cyclamen out, too, and they're going to hang in there pretty well with this kind of weather, too.
Yeah, what I'm telling people is, with things like cyclamen, if you have them in pots, move them maybe to a little bit shadier area, because that direct, intense sun can sure shorten their life, but... And same thing's true of geraniums. We sell a lot of geraniums this time of year, and I tell people they can take all-day sun now, but when we start getting really hot, you know, leave them in a pot that you can move into a little shadier area if you want them to go on into the summer months. What are your favorite annuals to be planting right now?
Well, back to the cyclamen for just a second. My garden works great for cyclamen because I put them in the ground for the most part, and pots too. but they're getting quite a bit of sun because of the deciduous trees, and as they start to leaf out, they start to give a little protection. So it works quite nicely. There's nothing that gives you a stronger splash of color than those things. They really work well. And you don't have to plant them all over the place. Just put them in focal points, and so people, you know, catch your eye from a distance. Other things, I haven't even started planting any summer things yet. I've got so much color from the fall stuff. It's going to be interesting to see how long the stock lasts. Mm-hmm. I planted primarily the purple color one, and I think it's going to probably last pretty well, but we'll see.
It's a great plant, and, you know, by itself or in combination. Roberta's got a couple of pots where she used a purple and white pansy, you know, as the low plant with that taller stock that's almost exactly the same violet-purple color. And she says it's boring because there are only a couple of things there, but I say it's beautiful. Golly, it is striking from a distance. And, I love flowers. And it's just stock is one of those things that many people don't even know about. And it's just one of the best, and I love it because it's so fragrant. Get that whiff. We used to sell a lot of cut stock over at my grandfather's flower shop over in Oak Cliff there in Dallas, and every time I smell it, it still takes me back to the days of sticking my head into the big flower cooler in his floral shop, and that was always the strongest scent in the place, was the scent of stock.
Oh, yeah. We have it right by the front door of the bed under and beside the Mexican buckeye, you know, that's letting the sun through it right now. And Gee's party, people were commenting about the fragrance and the look of that purple mass when they came in. Also planted a lot of petunias. It got various colors, and you can get quite a bit, depending on which varieties you use, but you can get quite a bit of fragrance from the petunias, too, and they'll last well into the hot weather also.
There's sure some pretty new varieties out there, too. They're the old standards, and some of them cascade a little bit more than others, but there's some new two-tone ones out there in colors I've never seen before, and some of them are a little larger flowered. My experience is the smaller flowered petunias tend to last later in the summer, but all of them should make it, you know, for at least, you know, 10 or 12 weeks planting this time of year, and that's a lot of color in a very inexpensive little plant.
Well, I got a couple of things for you based on some conversations you were having earlier in your show, if you want to talk about those for a second.
Sure.
One of the things that y'all brought up was persimmons, Japanese persimmons. You're talking about the astringency of of the fruit, you know, if you pick them too early. There's a couple where you don't have to worry about that.
Really?
The Fuyu and the Fuyugaki both, you can pick early, and they're tasty and non-astringent, picked early. So, plus the fact those are both pretty easy to grow. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember who told me that originally, but I've tried it, and it's definitely a benefit if you want to avoid that astringency problem.
Making note as we speak, and I appreciate that knowledge.
Fuyu, Fuyugaki, Fuyugaki.
Excellent information. I'm writing as fast as I can here. Fuyu, I'm not familiar. I'm certainly familiar with Fuyu, but Fuyugaki is a new one to me. I'll have to do a little more research on that one.
Yeah, we've had that in my plant books for some time, and it was one of the local herbalists, I think, that told me about that originally, and I tried it, and sure enough, she was right. The other thing related to James's question to you about what to add to the seaweed spray and fish, the thing that I would recommend, and it's a pretty strong recommendation, would be the vinegar, the apple cider vinegar, and compost tea. And if you do that, you will have made Garrett juice. And
absolutely.
That's, That's why I recommend carrot juice more than any other liquid by far, over and over again, because the vinegar, the outside vinegar, functions as a synergist for your seaweed and your molasses, like you're talking about having in there, and the other things. And you get away with being able to use a lower volume of all those things and still get the same kind of results. And it allows you to do it more often if you want to do it and still fit the budget. So that's one of the reasons I like, you know, the commercial product. Medina's Garrett Juice Plus is one that not only has compost tea in it, but also has liquid humate in it.
Right.
Which can help you with the detox situation. And then it has all those other ingredients that we just talked about, the vinegar, the molasses, and seaweed and everything. So you just use the one thing. What I'm recommending to the commercial consulting customers that I have now is one dry application of Medina growing green or some other good blend, organic fertilizer, and then the Garrett juice spraying and or drenching, depends on your time and your budget and everything, on a monthly basis. Some people will do it more often than that. But I'm not sure it's worth it. If you really want to push things along, the fertilizer value can make that happen, no matter whether it's asparagus or, you know, flowering plants or anything in between.
Well, if people have put in the other things we recommend, like the lava sand and the things that have that high cation exchange capacity, people who are doing it more often still don't have to worry about wasting it, because the things you just mentioned in the Garrett juice will be bound and held in the soil until the plants need them. So once again, it's not like the synthetic stuff that you probably lose 90% of. It just leaches away and pollutes downstream. But I just love these things that you know, that are bound if you've prepared your soil properly. And it's why things like the Garrett juice that have a much lower analysis, so to speak, are still so effective in getting the nutrients to the plants.
Yeah, that's right. I'm writing the specs right now. Well, one's a new project, and one is updating specs on a landscape project that I did a long time ago. And in both cases, it's the same in both projects. It's Medina growing green, you know, one time a year, and then the liquid Garrett juice treatment on a monthly basis. And one of them is a vegetable garden, the big vegetable garden thing that I've designed, and the other is just a residential project that's mostly trees. That's the other interesting thing about it. James was talking about onions. I've got a bunch of onions planted, and that's exactly what I'm using on the onion crop at our place too. So it just kind of goes through the whole gamut, and it's what makes it so simple to follow my recommendations, is to recommend the same thing across the board. Somebody was asking me the other day about phosphorus. You know, it comes up all the time. They got this soil test report, and I sent them a simple question. I said, where did the test come from? And I knew without even asking that it was an A&M test, because they told them there was too much phosphorus in the soil and not to use any organic fertilizers or compost or manure products for at least 3 years. Now, it would be hard to come up with a stupider recommendation. You could sit down and, you know, write down a whole bunch of stuff, but I don't think you could beat that.
They're giving
that kind of recommendation out a lot, unfortunately.
I'm surprised they didn't recommend following it up with Roundup, and that would have made it even stupider.
Well, the fertilizer they recommend is nitrogen-only products, urea. And, you know, across the board, you and I talk about this all the time, about the worst thing you can do, well, the most dangerous thing you can do, is to use one-element products on a consistent basis. You can make more you can do more damage to the soil using sulfur over and over again, or nitrogen over and over and over again, or whatever, zinc, molybdenum, or magnesium, or anything. That's why, you know, we're so high on these products that have this wonderful organic blend, because you have these background levels of all these things in the product, and they're buffered, so they're available, but not going to be a big problem. Zinc, you know, these people recommend putting out zinc on all the pecan trees. Man, you can cause some problems big time if you put that out and get it just a little bit too heavy.
Highly toxic.
Which could easily happen.
Yeah. It just doesn't have to be as hard as people, you know, try to make it. It's just not that complex. And once we get people converted and staying on the organic program, I don't know anybody that goes back to synthetic nitrogen and things. And I find it interesting. I read, I can't remember where it was the other day, but one of these eastern states, might have been North Carolina, I think it was North Carolina, the governor was begging the farmers to stop using so much of the, you know, synthetic nitrogen products because they were polluting the river so badly. And that's the other thing, you know, we probably ought to spend more time talking about, is you can really wreck your water source when you're using any of these fertilizers, that where most of it leaches away, and it doesn't just go through the soil, it goes down to our surface water, where it creates huge algal problems, and it gets down into our, you know, subsurface water, where it's very destructive to the water quality. So lots of reasons to stay away from it.
One other thing I heard y'all talking about that I'm very deficient as far as my publications is propagation. I've got two problems there. One is I'm just lazy about getting into it more myself. I tend to just buy plants that are what I need instead of getting into the propagation myself, cuttings and grafting and all that kind of thing. But on the other hand, I need to make a bigger deal out of it on dirtdoctor.com and more easily available. But there's a book that I recommend that everybody ought to jot down and try to get a copy of. And there's a little interesting factoid about this book. It's called Plant Propagation Made Easy, or just Plant Propagation. It's by a guy named Alan Toogood. And you can look online to buy it if you can't find it in local stores, and you got to be real careful because the first book that will come up that's that name, and it's the right book, but it costs $134.
Oh my God.
The second one that's the same book that comes up from a search will cost $16.95. So be careful as you purchase that book, but it's just a fantastic book for anybody's library that's a gardener.
Does it get into grafting as well? Because I'm deficient. I learned in college. I learned how to bud and graft, you know, things like peaches and plums, but I know very little about citrus grafting, and that's something that I really need to improve my own knowledge of. And does this book cover grafting as well?
Yeah, it does. I don't have my copy here. It's at the office, but it covers grafting and budding and seed and all kinds of stuff. It's kind of the state of the art. I've been recommending it for a long time. Like I said, I've got some real poor entries on dirtdoctor.com about propagation in general. I need to beef them up. But even after I do, the main thing that I'm going to be recommending on there is that book.
Well, I have totally gotten away from recommending the so-called rooting powders that have indole acetic or indole butyric. There's so little of it in there, and I'd suggest a Garrett Juice soak, and you know, brief for soft things like begonias and impatiens, and longer for woodier things like roses and you know, more woody shrubs and things like that. And I've not taken the time to try to figure out whether it's the apple cider vinegar or what. But people sure seem to have a lot better success rooting things. And there's some things out there that can be tough that people very commonly try to propagate, like bougainvilleas and hibiscus as well. And it sure does make it easier. Sure get a higher percentage of take on your cuttings.
Well, that's why I recommend it so highly all the time. I think, you know, you talk about the great products that Medina makes. I think Garrett Juice is the best thing they make. So anyway, whether you make it yourself or use their commercial product, if you haven't tried it yet, you need to it's not just for propagation, it's for all kinds of things. You know, it was invented to be a foliar feed, and then later we mm-hmm. discovered how well it was working as a root stimulator.
Right.
And then we got to looking at it, just using it as a drench, as a fertilizer, and that seemed to work really well. And if you had something that wasn't flowering quite as well as you wanted it mm-hmm. to, nothing set buds and got the flowers going better than it. So it's just a nice combination of all the things that are needed, you know.
What about the really hard seed, like maybe a little bit older bluebonnet seed or the Pride of Barbados came up? Do you recommend scarifying in addition? Do you recommend a longer soak in Garrett juice? What are you telling people about some of these seeds that are really have a tough seed coat on them? Mountain laurels will be another one in that category.
Well, somebody called me about mountain laurel on my show the other day, and I told them that I was putting them in charge of this research, and that is to scarify some of the seed, do nothing to some of the seed, and to scarify and do Garrett juice treatment to the others, and let me know which one works the best. I think a light scarification, just rubbing them on concrete or on sandpaper, mm-hmm. and a Garrett juice treatment is going to give you the best results.
Yeah, that's what I would expect to see, but it'll be fun. It's yeah. And we've got some fun customers, and they have time on their hands. That's what I am most envious of, is the time to do these things. But one of the fellows, and I may have mentioned it previously, but really keeps records, and he was talking about this guy grows his own tomato transplants from seed, and he had in the past had planted a seed, let the little plants get up to where they were making their first true leaves, and then started fertilizing. And he was using, I think, Hastagrow on them. And then he took a couple of seed trays, and he started with the Hastagrow as soon as those first two little cotyledons were showing on the surface of the medium. And he said that, you know, 4 weeks into the process, when he had nice little 4-inch transplants, the ones where he started that feeding early, as soon as you could see the green on the surface of the medium, he said those plants were stockier, thicker, much, much stronger plants. So this business of having to wait till plants get some roots established before you feed them, I think is not good, not a good information, apparently. But he has it all. He can tell you day by day and everything else, but very good, very scientific data about how much better growth he got by starting his feeding program earlier than most people recommend.
I totally agree with that. And it correlates with something that I'm recommending now, and that's to drench mm-hmm. the areas where you're planting things. So you're putting, you know, the liquid into ground before you even get germination going. One thing that the people that use Hastagrow might want to try is mixing the Garrett juice together with it. Mm-hmm. Might see some real powerful stuff. I don't use Hastagrow because I don't use any urea or any synthetic stuff at all. I'm a purist, but I think that the people that do use it, if they mix the other Garrett juice ingredients with it, you'll see even better results.
Well, and Medina's liquid fish blend, I don't think he's got yep. any urea in that, and I like that product at least as well as the Hastagrow. And I know with my orchids and things, I rotate, and it's just produced outstanding results. And yeah, I would agree with you, but that liquid fish product, if you're not using it, you might give it a try sometime, because we've seen really good things happen with it.
Well, it's great, and it's in the Garrett juice.
Yeah. Amen. Amen.
That's one of the ingredients in their Garrett juice. Anyway, I'll push Garrett juice enough. It's worth a try for those of you out there that haven't given it a whirl. Oh, well, I got something new on DirtDoctor.com, too, and I'm sorry to the people that have been waiting on this, but I did a talk in Flower Mound. Mm-hmm. About 2 months ago now. It's been way too long, or at least a month ago. And I showed up to give my talk, and I went up to put my flash drive in, and I hadn't brought it. I left it at home.
Oh, wow.
And so I did my talk without the flash drive, which works fine. In fact, I even enjoy doing that sometimes because I just do a different format, and I'm able to
interact with the audience quicker and answer more questions and everything. But I did tell everybody that I would put the slideshow into a form for it to be on DirtDoctor.com. And I had several people call me and ask me, where is it? You said it was going to be there, and it's not there yet. Well, it is there now, and it's right up in the top right-hand corner of DirtDoctor.com. It says Howard's Appearance. It's got too long a name. It says Howard's Appearances Slideshow or something like that. But you can watch it. It covers the slides that I would have had in the talk, and then cut lines under the slides about what you're looking at. And it's kind of an interesting way to do it because I had to write a real condensed little cut line, you know, for mm-hmm. each slide, and it worked out pretty good. I'm going to do it on other talks now and other subjects, I think.
Well, and I don't think there's, I think that's a good thing to do because I find, and I just flat, I don't have time to do the talks I once did. But the problem, and I very seldom use a lot of slides because people get to focusing on the slide and they don't hear what you say. And I think many times, that what you're telling them about it is absolutely essential information to being able to make good use of it. So it's, I think that little oversight on your part may have been a very beneficial result.
Well, it's kind of interesting. We've already seen kind of a tick up in people buying books and doing some of the other things, the online classes mentioned in my talk, mm-hmm. and also other videos about me doing the sick tree treatment on the lacy oak in our front yard at the office is mentioned in there. So I think there's going to be some related benefit. But anyway, check it out and let me know what you think about it.
Oh, my only problem is finding time to sit down in front of the computer. I, you know, start out hitting the ground early and there's so much stuff to do. And by the time I get home, I'm too tired to do anything other than go collapse. But that's,
I understand.
And everybody remember the daylight savings time starts tomorrow. And that's my favorite day of the year in many ways, because now I've got an extra hour of daylight in the evening. It's going to be dark when I go to work, daylight savings time or no, but boy, having that extra hour at the end of the day is something I always look forward to and always need.
Yeah, the only problem for you is you're going to have to get up before most people are going to bed.
Well, you do, like I say, find us the way to get about three more hours in every day and about one more day in every week, and I think we might actually get caught up with all our gardening, but then knowing you and me, we'd just find something else to do. And I've got a little 13-week-old golden retriever puppy is just trying to climb into my lap as we're talking here. So I'll have to send you some pictures of Axel sometime soon. And
he's just sent me one picture, a beautiful, beautiful dog. Congratulations.
And he is so sweet. He's trying to be a gardener now, but he sure doesn't know the difference between larkspur and weeds that you might want to pull up. So we've got a lot of training to work on here.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Howard, it's always much appreciated when you take a little time with us on Saturdays. And, again, that's the greatest comment I get about the Saturday show is, I love your segment with the Dirt Doctor. So you guys get out and have a wonderful weekend, and I've still got things to talk about. So I guess we're just going to have to do it again next Saturday.
Sounds like a good plan. I enjoyed it. Everybody enjoy those healthy gardens, and we'll see you next week.
Look forward to it, and want to hear about, you mentioned the big garden project was getting underway. Want to hear, have an update on that and how that's coming, too. So give Judy a hug, and, you know, have a great week. Give the pets a pet, and we'll look forward to next Saturday. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bob.
Certainly. All right, that's Mr. Howard Garrett, Dirt Doctor, and again, dirtdoctor.com. If you've not found that website, by far the best on the internet for our area because the information is local. Yes, Howard's in Dallas, but very few things are different in Dallas than they are in San Antonio and South Texas, perhaps a little bit of timing, but I sure think you'll find much more accurate information there than you will just about anywhere else. And if you don't have some of his books and the books that he and Malcolm Beck did together, well, your library needs to be updated. We're going to take a little break here. If anybody's on the phone lines, and the phone lines are open at 210-599-5555, looks like we've got about 24 minutes left in the show, and that'll be time for some more good conversation. So we'll be right back.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening, and let's get back to the phone lines here. It looks like the next couple of callers, well, actually, my next fall callers, or four callers, going to be Kathy and John and Kim and Men. So starting with Kathy, good morning.
Good morning, Bob. I'm using diatomaceous earth, the white kind, for my chicken coop, and my husband came home with some calcium, bentonite in where it said food grade diatomaceous earth. Is that the same thing? It's brown.
No, it is not the same thing, and I would be very reluctant to use bentonite around really any animals, but especially chickens. Bentonite is an interesting product. It's what they use to seal dams. Farmer or rancher goes out and creates an impoundment on his property, but it doesn't hold water. And so they go back and literally dump bentonite in because it will seal. It'll just, turn soil into clay and, help with water holding. So I can't think of any time that I would want animals to ingest bentonite. Diatomaceous earth is fine.
Yes, and it said diatomaceous earth with calcium bentonite, and it has every animal on the front cover, from llamas to cows to chickens, that you can use with them. And so I thought, I knew that it was more or less a different substance. Okay,
very small amount probably wouldn't hurt anything, and it's actually, for a while they were even considering, her government in action, taking bentonite off the market because they feared that it would be used to spread toxic agents like in a subway tunnel or something like that, very finely micronized.
Okay.
It's interesting material, and it has very good applications in agriculture, but I guess if they put like 1% in the DE, it wouldn't be a problem, but if it's much higher than that, and it may be just to try to reduce clumping or caking or something, but I'm still going to go with straight DE. It's cheap. It's easy to find.
Thank you very much.
It's great.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Have a good day.
You do the same. Thank you, Kathy. Goodbye. All right. John is next in line. Good morning, John.
You know, Bob, if we were talking baseball instead of gardening, your half hour with Howard Garrett would be like back in the 50s when I watched Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle come up to bat. It's just so enjoyable.
But, oh, yeah. Yeah.
Last week when y'all were talking about hydrogen peroxide, I wonder if anybody has ever confused hydrogen peroxide with holy water. But in any case, my gardening question before I get thrown off is blossom end rot 101.
Oh, blossom end rot results when you get an imbalance of calcium and magnesium in the soil. It's strictly a physiological condition, and it's due to micronutrients just getting out of balance, which happens pretty often in our alkaline soil. So that's why just Epsom salts, which is just magnesium sulfate, tend to bring that balance back into line and will totally stop blossom end rot. It's not a disease. It's not a pathologic condition in any way. It's just what happens when those two micronutrients get out of balance. And a lot of people don't realize it, but where you do have blossom end rot on a tomato, you can take that tomato and just sharp knife slice the bottom off of it. Nobody's going to know the difference. It's still a good, tasty tomato. But it's so easy to prevent with one of the cheapest things out there. There's no excuse for anybody to have blossom end rot in their garden.
Well, I had been trying tomatoes in a big molasses tub. So if I enrich my soil and keep doing that, I'm on the right path then.
Oh, absolutely. And if you want to make it a little bit, make it happen a little bit faster, you can simply dissolve your Epsom salts in water at the rate of 2 tablespoons per gallon and soak your molasses tubs full of soil with that. And you'll make absolutely certain that your soil's going to not contribute to any blossom end rot problems.
Well, that'll do it, and I appreciate it, and I'll let somebody else get on here.
John, I appreciate the call this morning. You have a wonderful weekend in the garden. And, Greg, let's get our last break of the show done, and we'll be back with Kim and Min.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening. Golly, where did the 3.5 hours go this morning? It's been a lot of fun, a lot of great questions. Y'all are the best in the world. Let's finish up probably with Kim and Min. Might have time to get one more in there, but we'll see. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning, Bob. I'm calling you with a quick question about hummingbirds.
Okay.
I hear your caller, Mark, that calls in from Fredericksburg often, and he talks about his number of hummingbirds that he gets, like, throughout the season. And I'm wondering if you can give any information on how you calculate the number of hummingbirds that you're getting to your feeders.
Well, maybe Mark will come and or will call in and tell us that sometime. I've never been to his place up there, and I wouldn't know how you begin to do that. But, you know, they have every year what they call a hummingbird roundup. I think it's originated down in Rockport or something like that, where they ask people to count hummingbirds. But once you get above, I mean, we usually have 3 feeders out, and once you get above about 10 or 12 birds, I don't know how on earth you would count them unless you, you know, took a still picture and went back and were able to pick it out. But that's a great question. I hope Mark's listening, and I hope he'll call in and tell us sometime, because what did he tell me? He goes through 20 pounds of sugar a day, and they might have out over 100 feeders or something like that. But that's a real good question. I have no idea how you would calculate how many.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
All right, Kim. Appreciate the call. Thank you. Next in line is Min. Good morning, Min.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
My husband listened to you every weekend up to when he passed.
And well, so, hope he keeps him out of trouble.
Yeah, well, now I'm calling you because my landscape, my front lawn, you know, due to the drought, I lost my front lawn. And I'm 89 now, and I have concerns about being watering and being out there because I fell last year.
Oh, goodness.
I couldn't get up for 2 hours.
Oh.
Anyway, okay, so listen, I'm thinking about getting the rocks or stones because I checked with the HOA, and they said that I can't be denied stones, rocks, or whatever because of the Texas law, you know, EPA and all that.
Right.
And I was happy to hear that. So can you, what type of rock would you recommend? I heard about Texas Blend. I was told not to get granite or whatever. So what do you think?
Well, I would go out to one of the material yards, and I would get what you like. Thinking that it is going to eliminate weeds and things is very much not true, because you will have weeds seed blow in, and I do not recommend putting down this so-called weed block fabric underneath it, because while that might keep some things from coming up from below your rock, you're still going to have, you know, lots of seeds blow in. And of course, you can get out there with that vinegar and orange oil mix. You certainly don't have to use a toxic product, but I would caution you that the Texas Blend and all of these river stones, whether they're large or small, are very hard to walk on. And if you're not real steady on your feet, you would be much, much better to go with something like a coarser granite or a coarser lava or something like that is much more of a walking surface, because Gosh, I've walked on, you know, cobbles on various beaches and things like that in some of our travels over the years, and it's darn hard to work on, even if you haven't been on this earth as long as you have, and if you're not real good balance, it is much easier to fall on the round rocks. Now, there are some crushed rock materials that will do the same thing. We're seeing that going into more centers and things, and I don't like it. You know, I like ground covers. I like green. I like soil that breathes. But going to rock is okay if that's what you want, but it does not solve all the problems, and it certainly does not create a weed-free environment for you. And like I say, you mentioned that you've been privileged with or gifted with long life, and walking on round river stone is going to be very hard.
Well, I won't have to, because my lawn guy will continue coming, he said, once a month at least to get the weeds there, whatever.
Well,
so,
that's good.
Yeah,
that's good. But if you anticipate that you might need to walk across, I would certainly suggest adding in, and this can be attractive, add in a few flagstones. And this is not just for you, but you might have guests coming. You might have, for whatever reason, people need to cross that area. And if you had a series of flat stones or even paved stones in there, it would certainly make it easier and much safer for people to navigate that sea of rock.
Okay. Now, let me ask you, is there any landscaping place around here? I'm in the Stone Oak area.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to your place with my husband over on Sunset, right?
Uh-huh, right.
Yeah, yeah, very nice.
Thank you.
So I'd like to really check around, you know, and because I have to provide the HOA with the survey and the stone, and I didn't know it's going to be so complicated dealing with that, you know.
Oh, yeah, dealing with HOAs is a royal pain, but you're fortunate that right there in Bull Verde, which is not too far away from Stone Oak, you have a really good company called Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S, Thomas Stone and Landscape. I recommend them all the time because they have the best grass I know of in the area, but they carry a wide array of stone, and Bill Thomas out there is a nice guy, and I would highly recommend that you go out and talk to them about what is available. I think you'll enjoy seeing the place, and I think you'll get you ask for him, and tell him I said take good care of you.
Okay, is that Bill?
Yes.
Bill Callis.
Yes. Bill Thomas. I always have to be careful because John Thomas is also a good friend who has Wild Seed Farms, but Bill Thomas has Thomas Stone and Landscape. They also have an outlet yard at Redland Road but I think that's mainly for grass. I think if you want to see all their stone products, but Bull Verde's just, you know, literally right around the corner from Stone Oak, so it shouldn't be too much trouble for you to find.
Oh, thank you so much. God bless you for your talent and your time and for knowing so much. My husband considered you his gardening encyclopedia.
Well, that's a compliment I don't really deserve, but let's just say I started out in my grandfather's flower shop when I was a whole 5 years old, and my training is as a research biologist, so I got a pretty good background, and best of all, I've been blessed with some wonderful mentors over the years, and just a pleasure to be able to share what I've learned here on KTSA for golly, a lot of years now. I hate to think of how many. So, man, you get out and enjoy a beautiful weekend out there, and please call me anytime you need information. That's what we're here for.
Thank you, dear. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Thank you. All right. Well, that pretty much wraps it up for today. A little bit over a minute left in the show. Get out and visit a good nursery. Let me tell you, the plant material is so beautiful right now, and oh, don't accept anything that's not just absolutely gorgeous, because nursery should be stocked with very good quality things now. Do remember, fertilize if you haven't done so in the past 90 days. You do need to get fertilizer out, whether it's dry or liquid. These windy days, tender bedding plants now, get them out of the wind, hanging baskets, things like that, because they really can't get severely dehydrated. If you've planted peppers and tomatoes and things, and I think it's certainly time you should consider doing that, but protect them from the wind. Put a cage around them, wrap that up with a little bit of insulate or other protective fabric, because the wind can be very desiccating and can be very, very hard on those plants. And it looks like we're going to have a windy day today, maybe a little bit tomorrow, but temperature is still going to stay moderate. It's going to be a little chilly. Do not be putting your desert rose out. Do not be putting your Chinese evergreens. Those are plants that do not like temperatures below 60 degrees, and looks like we're going to be down in the 40s in San Antonio, perhaps the low 40s up in the hill country, but at this point, they're not predicting anything anywhere close to freezing. Tomorrow, we're going to do a best-of show. Some of the staff at the radio station taking a day off. We will be back next Saturday to help you right here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.